And we are live from the Dayton Hamvention. This is year 2011. Now, we may not be here next year. They say 2012 is coming, and that's going to be that. Our goose is cooked. Now, this is kind of an interesting situation I've got here. Do you want to aid me with the mics here, because I don't know which ones. Are any of these on?
Someone sit down. There you go.
We have individual volume controls for each microphone. So this gentleman here is attempting to get the headphones free, and I'm going to let him introduce himself. He can't hear. Okay.
Good. Gotcha.
Okay. He's not quite loud enough, though.
Hello there.
Now he needs a little boost.
Hey, folks.
In the gain department.
Hello there.
Now, a little bit more.
Hey, testing 1, 2, 3. There we go. How you doing? Yeah. Hi, Ted.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm Bob Allison, WB1GCM, and I'm the test engineer at the ARRL Laboratory, right at the ARRL headquarters in Newington. Hello to all the listeners of WBCQ on 7415 and 9330. Oh, can I say hello to somebody?
No.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
I want to say hello to Tim Tron, and I also want to say hello to Marion Webster and Christina, and I think they have a cat named Electra. I'd like to say hello to them. Their radio show is pretty funny.
And, you know, why don't you go ahead and plug Marion's Attic? That is one of the most unusual radio shows that is on air. And, you know, I'll tell you, radio today, for the most part, is pretty boring, including our show. But if you tune into this thing, I mean, there's
an old lady plays old, really old records, and a younger woman, and they're very funny together and very, very unusual. So I thought I'd just want to say hello in case they're listening.
Well, you know, I guess a lot of those songs are on 78 RPM records, are they not?
And they play cylinder records, too.
Well, I know they play cylinders. I hadn't got there yet, but yeah. I was going to say that they play cylinders, but they also have a whole bunch of 78 RPM records.
I understand, yes. Yes.
Yeah. I remember 78s when I was a kid.
Yeah, me too.
because they were so brittle, you know, and if you dropped one, they would just shatter.
A lot of times, yeah.
You know, there were so many times you would drop a old 78, and it was like, you know,
that was the end of it. Even if it said unbreakable, they'd still break, or they'd fall on top of a lamp or in the radiator, and they'd melt, and then
Do you recall changing needles on a 78 RPM record player? In other words, they had these stainless steel needles.
But you'd flip over,
and they would wear down. No. I'm talking about little straight needles that went up inside the. And there's like a little screw that held them in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They were stainless steel, and they would wear down.
You'd
have to take them out and put another one in.
Well, I remember Marion saying something that you have to change a needle with every record, something like that. But I had an old machine like a Victrola when I was a kid, but I never knew about changing needles, so I always thought the phonograph sounded just bad all the time.
Well, you know, there were those that had, crystal cartridge pickups, and they had ceramic.
Ceramic, yep.
And they had little needles that would flip over.
That's right.
One side was for 78. You'd flip it. The other side was for 45, 33.
And 16.
Yeah. And I guess I came to the conclusion, I don't really know for sure that there was any difference in the stylus. I mean, supposedly there was, but...
Well, I think there's a groove dimension's different.
Well, you would think so, but I could never hear any difference. I mean, I used to play with it, flip it and play the song, flip it and play it again.
Well, I never had that good of a phonograph anyway when I was a kid.
Well, I remember, now you want to get into some dating. I remember the very first stereo cartridge that I ever had in a stereo, home stereo. It was a ceramic, and it was a Sonatone 9T, a little gold ceramic cartridge. And the first magnetic cartridges I ever heard was in a radio station. Mm. And I remember they put the tone arm on the record, and as soon as they dropped the tone arm on the record, I was absolutely amazed at how clear it was as compared to a ceramic cartridge.
Yep.
So anyways, we really wore that out. Is there anybody still listening?
Sure. Well, let me tell you what I'm doing here at the...
Tell me
here.
You know, I walk by it, and in the glass case, it said, well, AMSAT 1, is that what it was?
Oh, that's one of the things. I have a booth I'm running here. I'm the test engineer at the ARL laboratory. And for the past 3 years, we've had a kit building exhibition where it's people sit down and choose from a couple of kits. They can sit down, put together. We teach them how to use hand tools, how to solder. How to follow instructions, that's a hard part, and just sort of mentor them along the way. So people that have never built a kit before can sit down and do it. Ages 9 through 90 participate. But in front of my booth, I have a special, special exhibit, and that is of Oscar 1. And Oscar 1 was the first amateur radio satellite that went up into space. And it was put up on December 12, 1961. It sent the word hi in Morse code on 145 megahertz on CW. And it had a telemetry to let people know how hot it got, because the higher the temperature went inside the little satellite, which is about a foot square, the higher the temperature went, the faster it sent the word hi in Morse code. And that's how they determined the temperature of the spacecraft. It was also the first non-military payload that had ever gone up in space. And right now it's operating, for anybody that might be listening to WBCQ, it's operating on 145.08, although it's under Part 15, so it doesn't have to identify. It's sending the word hi, just as it did 50 years ago.
Okay, if it's operating under Part 15, my question is how much power does it put out?
Microwatts. It doesn't probably even make it over to this side of the arena. Maybe about halfway down this large room that we're in.
So, 100 milliwatts, tenth of a watt?
You're looking at less than a milliwatt.
Less than a milliwatt?
Less than a milliwatt, yes.
So how is it that you, I mean, that seems impossible. Well, it seems like that, you know, in other words, I understand a tenth of a watt or something like that you can hear. I mean, like you put a signal on the radio that's a tenth of a watt in a quarter of a mile.
Certainly. Well, I should sort of clarify that today we have a 50-ohm resistor, essentially a dummy load, on the output of Oscar 1. Originally, it had 140 milliwatts of output power, which was enough to pick up, transmit, you know, through clear space to a ground if you're within the illumination of the satellite.
So, in other words, the way this works is you have an infinitesimal amount of power can actually
just for here, yep.
Can actually from space
140 milliwatts from space is plenty of power
to be heard in an entire hemisphere.
Not an entire hemisphere, but I mean, because it was such a low Earth orbit, the diameter of the illumination was probably a couple thousand miles.
So, in other words, wherever the footprint was.
Yeah, you could hear it.
You could hear it.
Definitely.
You know, that's just amazing. And I guess now, but you think about XM and Sirius are up there.
Yep.
I don't know how much power they run. They run a lot of power, though. I mean, a considerable amount.
I don't think so. It's digital, too, and they can cut the power way down on that. But this particular Oscar, I just want to mention, was one of the original prototypes. It was built along with the one that went up in space. And we were very lucky to get a hold of Lance Skinner, who was one of the original builders of Oscar 1, who actually built it for a sum of $68. And it was built in his garage, and it went up on this rocket. And I'll tell you a really kind of a cool story about this, is that this particular bird was, the schematic diagram, for instance, was published in QST incorrectly. And that's so the Russians couldn't get a hold of it and kind of reverse engineer it. Also, two of the circuit boards that are in our prototype are actually incorrect. They were built incorrectly. So people couldn't take a picture of it and reverse engineer the keyer board and the timing board. So it's kind of interesting that it was purposely built wrong to misinform people. And the rocket that was featured on January 1962's QST was the wrong rocket. It actually went up on a Thorogena rocket because the Thorogena rocket was actually carrying a spy satellite at the time. So they didn't want to know what rocket went up. It was carried on.
We did an interview with a lady her name is, I think, Marie Esnault. And she talked about her husband being one of the pioneers in the satellite program. Does that ring any bells to you?
I'd have to go back and look at the literature that we have on our table, because that's not one of the names that rings the bell to me. But I haven't memorized. There were actually six individuals that worked on Oscar One.
Okay,
that actually built it. But Lance Skinner was one of the main people, and we were able to contact him, and he provided all the information, which is extremely helpful.
Well, I recall her telling this story, and part of the story got into President Kennedy, and I'm not sure how it all fit together, but she talked extensively about it, and it was interesting to hear. The whole concept of the thing was interesting to hear.
And by the way, an Oscar One was the first non-military payload that went in space, too.
Now, how many amateur satellites are circling the globe right now?
Well, we've lost a few. I would say a few dozen. A few dozen. Some only transmit telemetry. Some transmit only data. There's a couple that work with a 2-meter and 70-centimeter dual-band radio. If you have a dual-band radio and a very small portable dual-band antenna, such as the Aero dual-bander, you can, and you know where the satellite's going to be with satellite tracking programs, you can actually very easily go through satellites using FM handy talkies. So that to me is really, really fascinating.
Well, see, that was the other thing I was going to ask about, because I was thinking with that little amount of power needed, okay, and with that is why then is it you couldn't work a satellite with an HT, and you're saying you can.
Oh, most certainly. In fact, the satellites coming back are only running hundreds of milliwatts. They're running low power.
Okay, now, what kind of transceiver would you need to do this with? I mean, would a standard dual-band HT do this, or?
Yes.
Okay.
And some are called full duplex handy talkies. There's an Olinko one, a DJG7. I actually wrote the review for that particular handy talkie for QST Magazine. Not only did I get to test it in the laboratory, but I also got to review the radio. And part of the review was I was determined to make a two-way radio satellite communication QSO with this handy talkie and the Aero antenna. And I did. Worked out from Newington to Ohio using just a handy talkie and the antenna. The best part about a full duplex antenna is you can hear yourself coming back. And sometimes that's handy, but make sure you have a pair of headphones on. Otherwise, you can cause like a feedback loop.
I guess the other thing I was going to ask about is you said the Aero antenna. So, in other words, when you're doing satellite communication, you're not doing that with a rubber duck on an HT.
It's really hard to do, and unfortunately, there are people that have done it with a rubber duck, but there are many people that try to access this one channel as it goes overhead. It's Oscar 27 and Oscar, I think it's 51. You need the gain to sort of override other people that are trying to get into it at the same time. So, as you know, with FM, the loudest signal wins. So if you have a directional array, you'll be heard over someone that's just has a rubber duck. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it does work. A lot of users that want to use it.
But now this is what you're talking about, though, is a handheld directional array. It's not.
Yep.
It's not. Mounted. Now, of course, there's guys that get into this thing that have Yagis stacked up, and they're all driven by motors. And
that is kind of overkill. You don't need that much, actually, but it does help. Yes, you'll get through better than someone with a rubber duck or a small handheld Yagis, a dual-band Yagi, by the way.
Okay, now let me ask you this. Have you ever done any moon bounce?
No, although back in about 1980, when I first got onto 2 meters, I had two 11-element Yagis on 2-meter FM. And there was one time where I let go of the mic, and I heard myself identify. I thought, who's playing a recording? And then it dawned on me, I said, where's the moon? And I was using 100 watts at the time and two 11-element Yagis. And I said, where's the moon? I ran outside, and I could see the antenna was pointed right at the moon, and I heard myself come back again. And the only other experience I've had, interestingly enough, it was January, end of January of 2008, that HARP transmitter up in Alaska was doing an experiment where they were shooting up energy just below the 40-meter band and just above the 40-meter band, and they were on like 6.9-something megahertz, and they'd send a carrier, and then they go silent, and then you can hear the reflection come back. So I've actually heard EME very, very clearly from the HARP transmitter. And after that, we had terrible tornadoes and floods and I'm just kidding. Global warming.
So, I mean, do you, in other words, now, the fellow that runs HARP was here last year, was he not, at Dayton last year?
I didn't know, no. I was always busy with my kit building booth, so I never get a chance to get away like this.
It was either he was at here at Dayton or he was at Huntsville, and I can't recall now which one it was.
Well, I'd like to meet that guy. Again, it's just to create an ionized patch in the ionosphere to bounce a radio signal off of. It's nothing more scientific than that, really.
Well, I mean, there's so much rumor surrounding.
Oh, I know it, but
and not just rumor, but I mean like end of the world kind of stuff going on.
Well, it causes earthquakes, it causes nosebleeds, it causes arthritis, and yeah. I think most of it's junk science.
And the thing about it is there was a book out, and it was called Angels Don't Play This HARP.
Ah. Yeah,
and that book purports HARP to be just everything under the sun.
And do you know an average transmitter from a television station puts out more effective radiated power than a HARP array? It just HARP happens to do it on high frequencies. They don't do it on really, really low frequencies, like some people say, to cause earthquakes and stuff. They use high frequency waves, and the energy is minuscule. And it can ionize the ionosphere, but that's just about it. In fact, sometimes I think when we get into a ham radio contest and a whole bunch of people are getting on the 10-meter band at one time, I think that helps ionize that layer as well and bounce the signals improve when the bands are really active. That's my own theory, though. Doesn't make for interesting broadcasting, though.
Well, now that I got you on the hot seat here, though, you're the one that's actually doing all the testing of all the... I mean, you test everything under the sun that comes into the...
That's correct. We mostly rely on our membership to ask us and tell us what they want to see in the QST product review column every month. So we review HF transceivers, watt meters, linear amplifiers, amateur radio accessories. We review antennas, but we don't test them. That's because we just don't have a facility to test amateur radio antennas. But we test HF transceivers is the most liked part of product review, and we do a lot of those.
Well, now, I guess here comes the question here.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to go into any type of equipment.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to go into any name of any company.
Okay, got it.
But do you ever get stuff that comes in for evaluation, and you look at it and you say, you know what, this is a piece of junk?
Yes.
I wondered about that.
Yes, it does happen.
Do you remember the Gotham antenna company years ago?
Yeah, they made a really bad false antenna, something like that. Yeah. That was before my time at the headquarters. But one of the nice things about the product review process and what I do at the ARL lab is I get to test these an HF transceiver, for instance, thoroughly. And if I frequently find issues that the manufacturer didn't even know about. And one of the nicest things is we let that manufacturer know right away, long before that review goes to print. And they get to correct that problem. And we report it in our article. Hey, we found this. We contacted the manufacturer. This is their correction that they did. And usually they always fix any problems. If somebody bought an earlier radio with a lower serial number, they'll honor any kind of repair or modification that fixes that one problem that we found in the lab. But again, they fix the problem. It's addressed long before it goes to print. So we're there to help the manufacturer, not to bag them, but to work with them to help them make their products better. So you out there, the people out there that are ARRL members, you get a better product to buy from that manufacturer, and you benefit.
But I guess the question I have is if you are a manufacturer, let's just say of an amateur transceiver, you know, and you're putting that thing out on the market, and the league comes along and does... You know, field testing on the thing, and they come back and say, you know, this thing's got some issues with this, this, and this, and this.
Yep.
Kind of makes you wonder, has the manufacturer done any testing like that? Have they?
Well,
why haven't they? I mean, you know,
well,
I mean.
Well, sometimes I say to myself, don't they test these things? What's. Like, how could they miss that? And that does happen. And sometimes I think, well, they get us our free testing to test their transceivers. But for the most part, the big manufacturers have some very, very, very good test engineers. And I'm fortunate enough that I get to communicate with these people and have a relationship with them and have an open dialogue. And one of the nicest things is our procedure manual, the methods of how we test our equipment, how we test, let's say, HF radios. That's published on our website. It's a step-by-step procedure. The equipment that we use is explained, the hookup, step-by-step, etc. And I was very lucky. I was visited by the chief engineer of Kenwood, who develops all the HF radios. His name is Tori, Toshio Tori. What a nice gentleman. But he visited the ARO laboratory, and he told us that all of Kenwood's engineers in Japan use our ARL procedure manual to test their HF transceivers. So then he explained an error in the procedure manual of one of the drawings, and we all had a good laugh.
You were talking about the testing of antennas.
Ah.
Okay. You can't actually test an antenna, then.
You need a very special test range or a special room that looks like something called an anechoic chamber. It has all these, like, projectiles and protrusions from it to prevent reflections, because that's the hardest part about testing an antenna is reflections in the field or whatever you're doing. It's hard to compare antenna A to antenna B, and there's a lot of equipment involved as well, and then just the test facility costs, understandably, it costs, $2 million is the figure that's out there. We'd love to have one, but...
Do you get as far as being able to hook an antenna up and actually use it from that standpoint?
Certainly. We review antennas, so the reviewer actually gets to take the antenna, assemble it at home. They can write about how easy it is to assemble, how clear the instructions are. They'll put it up in their yard or on their tower and test it out for a couple months, preferably maybe even during a contest, so they get a really good idea how the antenna does. And then they report about that. And gain reports, we can take that same antenna design and put it in a computer modeling software program. And we use EasyNEC 5 at the league. And we can kind of look and see what kind of gain the antenna has, although the manufacturer has to provide us with very detailed modeling and information about their antenna in order for us to advertise the gain of the antenna. If you ever look at QST, none of the antenna ads have actual gain figures attached. They may say the highest gain in any Yagi ever. But no. They can claim a lot, but they are not allowed to actually advertise the gain figures of an antenna unless they provide us with some very detailed and specific information.
Well, all this is really interesting. Do you ever test any vintage gear just for the heck of it to see how it maybe stacks up against?
Well, I'm very much into vintage gear. I get on AM. I used to be on 75 meters a lot. I remember it's me, Bob, here. I used to get on the air and still have them, all my AM gear, with my command sets, my ARC 5 collection. Back 30 years ago, I got on with ARC 5s, and the old timers said, "Hey, listen to that GCM guy. He's running an ARC 5. I haven't heard an ARC 5 since the end of World War II." And I've always wanted to test command sets in the ARO laboratory, and I've been half tempted to do so. But once in a while, I'll get an older receiver in. Like, I just got a nice Drake R4C receiver that was donated to us for a novice station. We're creating a museum at the ARO laboratory of technology, and we're going to have a nice display of every single decade of amateur radio set up in the near future. And we got a nice Drake R4C, so I actually brought it into the screen room and tested a few things about it. It doesn't perform nearly as good as the newer radios, but they do a pretty good job.
Well, see, that was what I was going to ask, because, people like me, we are out there in the flea market area, and you're walking around, and you're looking at all these old boat anchors,
Yeah, I love
it. You see the Hammerland HQ-170s and the SX-101s,
yep.
And you see all these old radios, and including the Drake TR-4Cs and all that kind of thing. So you're looking at all this stuff. And you're thinking, you reminisce about the time that you had it, but there's something happens weird, and that is you don't recall how much that SX-101 drifted.
Well, that's right.
You know, and of course, now there's one you don't ever forget. If you ever owned an Ico 753 Tri-Bander, you know, that was, I mean, that had to be the driftiest radio that ever hit.
That's right.
You know, I mean, I've never seen anything drift like one of those. I was actually tempted to try to put a clock drive on the PTO to see if you couldn't just spin it slow enough to keep it.
Well, all of us are very nostalgic about radio. We all have sweet memories, so we kind of block out all the bad things of the past and remember the good times.
But anyways, you walk through the flea market and you look at all these things, and I don't think you really realize how advanced the new radio equipment is until you take and hook up one of those old rigs and turn them on and start listening. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. Can you think of, is there anything vintage you can think of that you could hook it up and you would say, well, you know what? This thing performs every bit as good as anything out on the market today.
Well, let's clarify that a little bit. Now, you take some lesser expensive transceiver, and I'll throw out a couple. There may be a transceiver that, let's call it the ICOM 718 and the Yaesu FT897, and something like that. Now, they don't have roofing filters in them. They still have DSP, and they do a great job with filtering. And a lot of those bottom-of-the-line, lower-end transceivers perform better than some of the best of the old days. Now, I own a Collins-built R390 receiver from the 1950s. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful receiver. But how does it do in the third-order IMD department? Or how does it block adjacent close signals? Well, the newer radios do a better job in that regard. And another receiver that I've owned is the Collins 75A4. Hard to top that radio. But if you ever have a close adjacent signal, did you ever notice the volume drops down? Well, that's because it's called blocking dynamic gain compression. Let me say that again. Blocking gain compression dynamic range. This is when you have a really strong signal that actually will lower the audio of the signal you're trying to hear. And you notice a lot of the old receivers actually do that. But for casual operating, some of these old radios are just totally satisfactory to use. Wouldn't want to try and use them in a contest, seriously, but I would like to use them just to have fun rag chews with people with similar interests. You can't beat it.
So I guess if you were to take a radio, and I'll use this generically, I guess as generic as I can get, but I am mentioning a brand name.
Go ahead.
If you take a radio, like say for the entry level ICOM 718,
yeah,
okay, as an entry level radio, that is an impressive little rig.
It most certainly is.
Okay, now you take that and compare that to a Drake TR4C.
Yeah, well, I don't know all the specifics of a Drake TR-4C. That was a good radio in its day. It had some pretty good filters in it.
Or let's just take the receiver section of an R-4C. I mean, let's just take, because that's a radio almost everyone is.
Yeah, but you know, the 718 has noise reduction circuitry in it. It has DSP, digital signal processing in it. So it has just advanced technology that makes it a better radio over the older radio. I mean, the TR-4C is great. I'd use it any day, and I'd love it, and I have a lot of fun with it. But, you know, if I was really relying on that radio for, let's say, an emergency communication system, and I wanted to get something right out of the box that's going to turn on, and I'm not going to have to mess around with anything, well, I'd go with a modern, simple radio right out of the box. And we always have to remember as radio amateurs that one of the reasons why we exist is to provide emergency communications as well. And that's a really good out-of-the-box emergency communications radio. We use those in our ham aid kits that we actually provide to disaster areas. Whereas the local section managers declare a disaster, they may ask us to send us some radio equipment down to where their problems are, the flooding or fires or hurricanes. We provide amateur radio equipment. And amateur radio operators are known for going to disaster scenes because they're trained in radio emergency communications. But unfortunately, they can only stay down there so long, and they usually have to take their radio equipment back with them. So the ARL has a plan called the Ham Aid Program where radios are sent down to disaster areas, and then the equipment stays there until the disaster's over, and then they send it back to ARL headquarters. So something simple out of the box like the 718 is perfect, and we use that radio.
Well,
we're not sending down TR4Cs.
No. However, if we get hit with an EVP, you see.
let me tell you this. Do you know what the biggest EMP problem that we have today is? Lightning. That's an electromagnetic pulse that is the same kind of pulse that would be generated from the sun or a nuclear disaster or whatever. But lightning is the biggest EMP you can get. A close lightning strike is far worse than a bomb detonated hundreds of miles away or wherever.
So think of it this way. I can take all of my solid-state radios out of the old microwaves
that I got stacked
up in the ham shack.
Yes. We can also all take off our tinfoil hats, too, because we'll be all right as well.
But if we do that, then the aliens can pick up our brainwaves.
That's right. And if you notice, I have this band aluminum on the back of the neck where the implant is. Boy, it's really been itching lately. Could you pull that out with those tweezers? Thank you. No, EMP is a big deal. That's your big electromagnetic pulse is lightning. So people that really worry about their breaking their radios, well, if you have a lightning strike a quarter mile away, that's a bigger electromagnetic pulse than anything else that could happen, bigger than anything else.
But what about the fact when they're talking about when they detonate an atomic bomb or a neutron bomb or something like that even automobiles within 15 miles of ground zero are completely disabled and cannot run. That's a powerful EMP.
Yeah, that's a possibility. But if lightning strikes your car too, or strikes nearby, it could do the same thing. It could shut you down. And aircraft, of course, they're flying through clouds and lightning, and there are dozens of failures of electronic systems aboard aircraft every single year. So it's through electromagnetic pulse, which is lightning. That's the biggest thing you have to worry about.
Well, I was wondering about that. And I wonder sometimes about when we get hit with things we don't necessarily know what they are.
Yeah.
There's this thing called ball lightning.
I've seen that.
I've never seen ball lightning.
Before I started as an engineer, test engineer at the Aero Laboratories, I spent 28 years as a television engineer at Channel 30 in West Hartford. And for a year, year and a half solid, I was the transmitter engineer on top of Rattlesnake Mountain in Farmington. My boss used to tell me, Bill Canaro, he's still around, tough Italian guy. He says, Bobby, I'd never want to catch you with your feet up on that desk up here. Only if there's a lightning storm are you allowed to put your feet up on the desk. And, you know, he was right, because we used to attract lightning with our 1,000-foot antenna all the time, and it would come down, it would come in the building, and it would be always some sort of spark, and something would fail or whatever, and the lights would go off, and the generator would come on. One time I was there, and I had my feet up on the desk, and all of a sudden, flash, bang, and this big streak and ball went right across the floor and went into a trench. And it scared the you-know-what out of me, because it moved very close by. Talk about electromagnetic pulse.
Well, see, I was told that ball lightning can actually, like, pass through a window and get inside of a building.
Certainly.
And then discharge and pretty well near blow the place all to pieces in the process. This is what I was told. Now, you hear these things.
I believe that.
But you don't know how much of that's true. I mean, you know.
Well, if the lightning can come all the way down from the sky or from the ground all up to the sky, it's going to pass through things like wood, glass, et cetera, et cetera. It can do that. And the power of lightning is really quite awesome. And it's something that you should respect, especially if you're an amateur radio. Disconnect your antennas. I had barrels outside my house to disconnect all the coax. And I certainly think that everybody out there with an outside antenna should have some sort of surge protection, lightning protection. Even if you have all the lightning protection in the world, that doesn't guarantee that lightning can't come in your house and blow something up.
Okay, now here's what I have.
Okay.
I have open wire line.
Yeah, good, good.
I'm a believer in the old Johnson kilowatt matchbox.
Yes, beautiful.
Link coupling.
Yes.
And open wire line.
Beautiful, right?
That's
nothing wrong with that.
That's my way of doing things.
Yep.
But now what I've got on my open wire line, where everybody likes to try to make open up a hole in the wall and stick to something.
Well, tubes out there, certainly.
Right, well, No, I'm talking about feeding it into the house.
Okay? Yes.
Okay, I have a place where it comes in, but I disconnect the thing, and I drop it outside.
That's exactly what I do.
I have a rope on that feed line.
Sure.
I don't I'm trying to talk and it's not working too well. Have you ever had that happen to me?
You're perfect.
Anyways, but I'll drop it outside.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why I drop it outside is I had it indoors at one point, and I was upstairs. And I had to go some distance with it, so it was kind of, I want to say, about a foot and a half away from an inside wall and traveled a little ways. Well, all of a sudden, I'm upstairs, and I hear this crackling sound,
yeah.
Snapping and crackling, and this piece of transmission line had been pulled right up against the wall. I mean, it was slammed up against the wall like a balloon you've rubbed on your shirt,
uh-huh.
And stuck it to the wall, okay? And then a few minutes later, I heard the crackling and popping, and then it relaxed, and it fell back away from the wall.
Wow.
You know, and then all of a sudden, a few minutes later, shoo, bang, up against the wall again. And I thought, I wonder how much charge there's got to be in this.
Well, an antennas can build up a lot of charge, when, let's say, when there's a cold front comes through. It builds up a tremendous amount of static electricity. And that's why, in a way, you want some sort of static arrestor on your transmission line, because that high voltage will build up and it can damage the front end of receiver, for instance.
Let me tell you what. I can always tell, usually, if there's bad weather coming, because the Johnson matchbox will sit there and start snapping.
Yeah.
You'll start hearing this, you know, and you wonder, what is that? And I looked around, and it's a back, because I don't use coax. But the SO239 on the back of that thing
starts arcing.
Arcing like an arc gap, and it just arcs right across there.
That's,
and it'll arc and, arc and arc,
yeah.
and it'll get a rhythm going. It'll be a snap, 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 mm-hmm. like that, and then it'll get faster and faster, and then it'll stop. You know, it's like.
Right.
So the amount of power that's available there, I've often thought. So the fear to me is with that piece of wire there, if for some reason that antenna were to take a direct hit, it doesn't matter. If it's coming in the house, it doesn't matter if it's disconnected. It's going to bring every bit of that inside the house, and it's going to try to figure out somewhere to go.
That's right.
And so I drop it outside. It's a pain.
It is a pain, but you just have to remember to do it, and that's exactly what I do.
And living in Tennessee,
yeah.
I've seen thunderstorms blow up in the middle of January. You know, I mean, it's just,
we have thundersnow in New England.
Thundersnow?
Yeah, thundersnow.
Well, Bob, I thank you so much. I know you're telling me you got to get moving.
Yeah, I got to get back to my kit building booth. I want to make sure my volunteers that are there are attended to and everything is going okay. And I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today, Ted, and thank you for letting me on your show. And for all those listening out there, thank you. If you're ARL members, thank you for supporting the American Radio Relay League through your membership. And just remember that the spectrum that we use is always under the gun to be taken away by other interests.
Far
so
more than what most people realize. They have no idea how under the gun it is.
And, you know, by supporting the ARRL, there's the Spectrum Defense Fund. If you have any extra dollars, I'd ask you to please donate to that. So our interests in Washington, D.C., our lawyers, can go to battle for us radio amateurs to make sure that our spectrum is not auctioned off to the highest bidder. And so that's what we at the one of the very small things that we do at the ARRL. But we're there to represent you. We can't please all the members all the times, but we do the best to represent your interests in amateur radio. So thank you on behalf of the American Radio Relay League. And don't forget to check out the product review column. I'm the test engineer, Bob Allison, WB1GCM. And thank you for everything, Ted.
Yeah.
Good work, and have fun at Dayton.
See what
they got the field day shirt on.
Yeah, we both have the field day
shirt. I got to get you another one.
we went. Anyways, I was going to say one thing, and that
okay.
is this. While you're sitting there.
Okay.
The ARRL, at times, I've noticed, and you can't help but notice, becomes a subject of controversy with some hams. Okay?
Yep.
And I would like to say that I would like to invite radio amateurs to consider the fact that if you have something about the league that you don't like,
by all means, contact us.
Take it to the league.
Yep.
You know, in most cases, what I've heard is it's been some amateur somewhere that basically is kind of stepped out of line, that has an appointment with the league or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's been, you know, some local person. You know, and but the thing with this is, what people don't realize is, that doesn't represent the entire league.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're a member, you've got just as much representation as the guy that you got upset with.
That's right.
You know, and you need to, instead of get your feelings hurt and go away, you need to jump in the middle and get involved in it.
And you also have to contact your division director. If you have any issues with the league or any problems, if you don't like anything that we've done or any of our decisions, just let us know. I mean, that's what we really want, is we want that feedback. That's very important. And I just want to also remind people that, remember, the ARL is a not-for-profit business. We're not in it for the money. We're in it because of the love of amateur radio, and we're in it, and the money that we generate through the sales of our publications, through membership dues, and advertising that you see in our publications, and the shirts and the books that we sell, all that kind of stuff, that money is used to pay for programs such as the education branch, where we invite teachers in. They learn all about electronics curriculum and science and electric magnetism programs that they bring back to the classroom. That's a service we provide to educators.
Well, the other thing too, and, let me just say that something, a person joins, and I think it's one of the best deals there is.
Yeah,
but you know, you get QST, the not just the magazine mailed to you, but you get the complete QST archive. Going back to, I don't know, it seems like it goes back to before Christ. It goes way back.
It goes all the way back to the very beginning of the first issue of QST, which is December 1914. You log on to our website as a member, and you can go back and look at any periodic. You do, there's a periodical search archive index that you can look through, type in a keyword or an author's name or a call sign or even a year, and you can find the article that you want. And that's very useful.
That is incredible. You know, and then on top of that, there is, you know, I'm a radio engineer. I got another radio engineer sitting over here next to me, Ted, sitting here. I'm Ted. He's Ted.
Hi, Ted.
Try it there.
Hello, testing.
That's not
3-4. CQDX, 40 meters.
There he goes.
Now, here's the deal. If you go into radio stations across the country today, it used to be that you would find the NAB Engineering Handbook. Big, thick thing.
You betcha. Like I had one.
Two or three thicknesses of a yellow page directory. Okay, now, radio stations across the country, you're more apt to find the ARRL handbook, radio handbook.
Yep, radio
or two
handbook.
Or three editions of it on the shelf, more so than you would the NAB broadcast handbook. And that's just a fact.
Because there is so much stuff in that ARRL handbook, from basic electricity to electronics to circuits to some of the most advanced stuff that's out there now. It literally runs sunrise to sunset as far as the theory is concerned, and the theory behind the operation of the circuits as well, too.
Most certainly. And I got to run to my project building booth, but I want to say this also, that members of the ARRL get another free service that they don't even realize, and that's our technical information service. If any member of ours has a technical question, they don't know how to build a dipole, or they want to find out what the value of this resistor is in this amplifier, they can contact the ARRL laboratory, and we can get the answer for them. It could be any radio-related question. We'll find an answer for you, and if we don't know it, we'll look it up and find that problem and solve your problems if you have radio frequency interference from power lines. We have a guy for that. We have a guy who is a know-it-all on every single topic of radio. His name is Zach Loud, WB1VT, Mike Gruber. W1MG is our RFI expert. Then we have our lab dad, who is Ed Hare, W1RFI. Worried about BPL? Maybe your AT&T U-verse problems? Huh? What? Yeah, that's a big problem these days. So we're working on behalf of you to help you solve your problems, the ARRL Technical Information Service. And call the main switchboard, and they'll route you into the laboratory, and we'll answer your questions. That's a free membership service that maybe you don't realize you have as a member.
Well, I thank you much.
All right, back to the booth, and thank you, Ted Randall. See you on the radio wave sometime on WBCQ.
That's right.
Monticello, Maine, USA.
And we also want you to tell them again the times, because I don't know. When is Marion's Attic on now?
Oh, let me think about that. Marion's Attic. Marion Webster. 5 o'clock on Sundays, 5 p.m. Sunday. I just like those cylinder records that she plays. That's pretty wild.
Last year she stopped by the booth here.
I heard that. In fact,
she may come back again this year. I don't know.
I was on the other side of the room. I was all excited when I heard about it after the fact. But that's too bad. I missed her. I would have liked to
shake her hands. Thank you for coming by here. And if you see her at some point, send her over here.
Okay, we'll
let her talk about Edison.
I heard she loads up her walker, has an antenna. So if you see an MFJ antenna tuner attached to it, that's her antenna. A little rubber feet insulate the walker from the ground. Makes a good antenna, so I think. All right, Ted, see ya. 7-3.
Yep, 7-3.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. You're listening to a live broadcast. We're coming to you from Dayton, Ohio. And this is the Dayton Hamvention 2011. And we're glad that you've tuned us in here. We're on, actually, Rod Hambry has let us occupy his time today on 93.30. And we want to say thank you so much. And normally, of course, if you're tuned in expecting to hear their programming, they'll be back at their normal times after the Hamvention's over with here. And in the meantime, we hope you enjoy listening to what we're doing here. So I also want to say hello to Ted, who just sat down. And
Ted Alexander, W8IXY.
And Ted is from the Cleveland, Ohio area.
You've been a broadcaster in Cleveland for almost half century now.
You're not that far from home here, so.
No, it's about a 3.5-hour drive. This is about my 35th Hamvention. First one I was down here to was in 1962.
You know what the funniest thing in the world is? We got one of these GPS units. So it's a TomTom. And when we get into the area, the voice lady, you know, she talks about, you know, go straight to Toledo. And I sat there and I thought, where is Toledo? Where could that possibly be? And it's just hysterical. I mean, the first time I heard it, I was laughing so hard, I had tears in my eyes. Toledo. Have you ever heard of Toledo?
I think I've heard it pronounced that way, but there are several other Ohio, let alone some other states and other parts around the world, too, with some odd pronunciations. For instance, there's a town in Ohio called Medina, but most people pronounce it Medina. And, in fact, in Minnesota, there's an Edina. But it's spelled E-D-I-N-A, same spelling.
I had an aunt that had something called edema, and they took water pills for that. Oh, well, never mind. I was just trying to, you know.
Well, look at Conneaut, Ohio, spelled C-O-N-N-E-A-U-T. People say, what is that, Canute? And then just some spellings that are different. A suburb of Youngstown, Ohio, is spelled C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L, just like the soup, but it's pronounced camel, like the cigarette. Oh, wait, we can't say cigarettes on the radio anymore, can we? That's it.
I think what it is, they don't let you to smoke them on the radio.
Oh, okay.
You can't smoke them on the radio. If the listeners see you smoking a cigarette on the radio, that you got to. Gentleman just sat down here who is an expert on satellites.
Hi, Ted. How are you?
Wow.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm eating the microphone. My name is Keith Baker. I'm KB1SF. I also have a Canadian call, VA3KSF. And like you, I was in broadcasting many years ago, back when I was working my way through college. So, I wanted to stop by and say hello and tell people that some of the stuff that we're doing with a group called AMSAT, which is the Radio Amateur Satellite Corporation, a nonprofit organization that builds and launches amateur radio satellites. In fact, we had Colonel Doug Wheelock just over at our booth, the astronaut who was on board the International Space Station, just returned. And I wanted to let everyone know we have a satellite actually up there at the moment in the International Space Station that hopefully sometime the end of July is going to be dropped overboard by one of the cosmonauts, and it will be available for, it has a downlink on FM on 2 meters, and it has something on the order of about 15 different languages, greetings in 15 different languages, and it'll be going on all the way around the world. We also have a transponder on it, so if you're so equipped, you can communicate through it. So this is one of our latest activities. We have three more of them in the barn ready to fly. And with the assistance of NASA, and in this case we're working with Energia, which is the Russian space agency, they're helping us launch this one. They gave us a free lift, if you will, up to the International Space Station. It was launched out of Russia. And hopefully NASA will be assisting us in the future. In fact, NASA's helped us with this one to get it to work all the paperwork and get all of that sort of stuff done. So lots of exciting things going on in the amateur satellite world at the moment.
A person that has an interest in getting into satellite communications, experimenting with it.
Absolutely.
Where do they start?
Well, probably the best place to start, if you're in internet-equipped, is to go to our website, which is www.amsat.org. And there's all kinds of information there. There's links to various and sundry getting started kinds of things. I've been doing a getting started satellite column in Monitoring Times magazine as of late, and also in our journal to help people get started. But there's a lot of information available right off our website. There's lots and lots of links there for people to get started, because it's kind of a mysterious thing. You know, you say, well, I communicate through a satellite. Wow, I didn't know I could do that. But in reality, with a nothing more than a handheld and a small antenna that you can hold in your hand.
Well, it makes me wonder how many people can actually fathom the fact that as a hobby, you can work through a satellite.
Absolutely.
And as you were talking about the astronauts
That's
earlier,
right.
You can talk directly to the space shuttle.
Correct. And it's not only do the it's called amateur radio on the International Space Station. It's called ARIS. Not only do they communicate by way of amateur radio to school children, which absolutely changes lives. It's a life changer for a youngster to talk directly to a satellite, to an astronaut in orbit. But you can do the same thing.
You talk about an experience that got to me. The very first ham convention that I was at here in Dayton was in 1962, and they had Oscar,
yes.
Orbital
yes.
Satellite
yes.
Carrying Amateur Radio.
Yes.
We passed that thing around. We looked at it.
Yeah.
We said, why? What other hobby in the world can you not only have a satellite launched, but talk through it?
That's right. In fact, Oscar 1, which was the very first satellite that went into orbit, was literally built in people's garages and basements. And it was launched, if you can believe this, they launched it using a thermally balanced, very, very high-tech spring, which came out of Sears and Roebuck. $1.19.
I seem to remember that. It's a Boeing, and
yeah, that's
it
all
it's
it was.
In orbit.
In
Amazing.
Fact, Oscar 1, which is the amateur satellite, Oscar 1 was the very first satellite to be carried as a secondary payload on a rocket. The very first. I mean, you know, Air Force, of course, at that time, it was the Air Force was the only game in town that was launching satellites. But yes, the amateur satellite community has been on the cutting edge of satellite development, and we've flown all kinds of firsts. We flew the first CMOS devices in space.
Well, right? Amateur radio has been involved with satellites since there's been satellites.
Pretty much. 1961 was the first one.
I'm thinking back to Sputnik in 1957.
That's
there was
right.
A high school radio club that I was proud to be part of. I didn't come on to that year, but at St. Joseph High School in Cleveland, Ohio, they actually invented a thing called an orbitometer.
Yes.
They would take they were on 20 megahertz. They would take the 20-meter beam, they would point it over to the horizon. They'd time the horizon on it, the orbit time, and they say, within 30 seconds or so, we'll acquire the signal.
Up it pops.
And there it was.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, amateur radio at some of its finest. And these were 15-year-old young guys.
Absolutely. Well, one of the reasons that the Russians put the downlink beacon at 20 megahertz was that it was very close to an amateur radio band. And they knew that hams were able to copy that thing. That's why they put it there.
And they did. I don't know how many people remember CQ magazine. They actually had a oscilloscope trace as
yes.
the cover shot
yep.
of that magazine. It yep. was made at that high school yep. radio club.
Yep. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, the ARRL was given the backup for Oscar 1, the backup satellite. And the folks there in the lab, as I understand it, have been refurbishing it, and they've actually got it back on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was supposed to be here at the Hamvention. So,
and that was the old analog days here.
Absolutely.
And now look at the advanced communications that we can do through the satellites that you do with an antenna. Almost handheld.
Handheld. In fact, I have done that in my backyard with a handheld and a handheld antenna. have communicated not only to the International Space Station, but I've also talked to the Mir space station before it came in, but also with our satellites 500 and 600 miles up in orbit. So it's just this hobby is just amazing.
It's a communications hobby, but so many facets.
From
literally antenna to antenna, yep. Your signal around the world, yep. out into space, yep. And just the listening aspect of it. I mean, if you've got the antennas out there for, say, like the AMSATs and stuff, if you point your antenna at the planet Jupiter, you can hear radio emissions from Jupiter. Yep. You can hear it from the sun.
Yep. Well, in fact, there's a group of AMSAT folks in Germany that I was working with when we were building the Phase 3D satellite, which you may remember. They did the first bounce of a signal off of Venus. And actually, they got a signal back. Mm-hmm. They bounced it off of Venus. So these hams, we're just doing all kinds of fun
things.
What's
coming up next for us?
As far as our satellite is concerned, we're waiting to have this Arisat, which is on board the International Space Station, tossed overboard, hopefully sometime in July. And we're also working on a very small set of satellites. We call them CubeSats. They're about 4 or 5 inches on a side.
Are you serious? They look like a Rubik's Cube size?
They're basically, they're a little bit bigger than a Rubik's Cube. They're about 5-6 inches on a uh-huh. side, weigh about 5 pounds, and you can launch multiple of these things out of a little, for lack of a better term, a gun. But it's a little box with a little spring on it and a little door that pops open, and these things just pop out. Again, one of our ham radio operator compatriots has been pioneering this concept.
What do you have to do to make electronic circuitry work with airless environment?
Well, it's the biggest problem you have is moving heat around inside the spacecraft, because you're going from, you know, full sun into full darkness every 45 minutes. One of the big limiting factors has been dealing with batteries, because as you well know, in any kind of a ham radio, you know, you recharge a battery and then it discharges, and you can only do that so many times. Well, you're doing that every 45 minutes. One of the things we're working on, if you wander over to our AMSAT booth, we've got a group of folks from the State University of New York are assisting us as students, again, a student project. They are experimenting with things called supercapacitors. Rather than a battery, they're experimenting with supercapacitors that look about the size of a AA cell, but are capable of about 2.5 volts at 230 farads. Farads, not microfarads or picofarads.
Explain that to somebody who might not be technical.
A farad is a unit of capacitance, and normally, years ago, a farad capacitor would occupy a flatbed trailer truck. Mm-hmm. Now it's down to the point of looking at even smaller than a C-cell battery.
All right, if we compared that to a C-cell battery and you put a 2.5-volt light bulb on it, we might get a light bulb to go for 3 days on a C-cell battery. How long would it go on this capacitor?
Well, one of the things that obviously going from daylight to darkness, we're looking at hopefully an on-year or an orbit life of about 17 years.
Wow.
Instead of 4 or 5.
So you're not charging and discharging a battery, you're charging and discharging a capacitor.
Correct.
Of which was one of the very first inventions that goes back to like Leyden jars.
Absolutely.
Of the, 18th century.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So and of course, the electronics have all shrunk down too. So it's just amazing what's going on in this world. And hams are still very much on the cutting edge. Well, anyway, we've been chatting away here, Ted.
Oh, it's been wonderful. I'm sitting back here and just observing and listening, and
lots of things going on. It's an exciting time to be in ham radio, believe me.
When I asked what does a person need, you said basically an HT. For those that have never done any operation of satellites at all, why don't you give them a brief description as to what they would do and how they'd go about it? Like, for example, now, if you have an HT like this HT here, is that a dual bander?
Yes.
That's a dual band HT.
Okay, normally our satellites are like repeaters, if you're familiar with the concept of a repeater.
Oh, yeah.
Except that they normally work as a crossband repeater, because we don't have the room on the satellite to put all of the duplexers
and all
of that.
When you say crossband, that means
you go up on one band of frequencies and your signal comes down or comes through the satellite and comes out on another band.
And it's easier designed because the frequencies are farther apart.
Exactly. Normally, our satellites operate on 2 meters, either up or down. or 440 megahertz, 70 centimeter up or down. That's where most of our satellites are located are in terms of our frequencies right now. So the satellites are in what we call a low Earth orbit most of the time. They're up about 500 miles, which means that you get about a 15-minute window about three times a day. There'll be one satellite because they're in polar orbits. They go over the North and South Pole. So as the Earth turns underneath the orbit, you'll get a shot at it off to the east for maybe 3 or 4 or 5, 10 minutes. Then 90 minutes later, you'll get another shot of it. It'll hopefully just about overhead. And then you get another shot at it as it goes off to the west. So you get and that happens twice a day. So you get about 3 to 4 to 5 orbits a day.
All right, for a hobbyist who wants to hear this, what kind of an antenna do they have to use?
You can use it with a ground plane, a normal ground plane. If you're monitoring, if you have a scanner.
Oh, when you're talking about a ground plane for somebody who's never heard of this before.
Just a vertical antenna, a little quarter wave made out of a coat hanger or something.
All right, that frequency, we're talking about a 25-inch piece.
Yeah, something like that, 19, 20 inches, something like that.
Wow, you could literally make it out of a coat hanger.
Yeah, absolutely, and a lot of people do.
But now, there's some folks here that sell these little handheld antennas, and what I'm talking about is you can see them. It looks like they have vertical and horizontal polarization, and it looks like they'd have maybe like a 440 antenna polarized in one direction and 2 meters in the other direction.
That's right. There's a
crisscross kind of thing.
Yes, there's a couple of manufacturers that are doing that. They put a 10-watt duplexer in the handle. And then if you can just hook it up to your radio and work it that way. If you're not equipped to, one of the things that's nice to have is what we call full duplex operation, where you can transmit and actually hear your own signal come back down through the satellite, which is much like a telephone would be. But you can, even if you don't have that, you can still do half duplex, which is transmit, receive, you know, when you transmit and receive that way. And you can usually communicate through the satellite that way. So it's very fairly easy to get started. And like I said, our website has a lot of information for those people that might be interested in doing this.
Now, you don't have to be a nerd to be into ham radio.
Absolutely not. In fact, my background is in financial management, so you know I'm a bean counter. In fact, that's one reason why they made me the treasurer of AMSAT after I served
something
as president.
For everyone.
Yeah, and that's the fun part is because it's an avocation in some ways rather than a vocation.
Well, as for me, it turned into a vocation too because I got my early training on
absolutely.
It. And that led to a whole radio broadcast career.
Yeah, well, I got my feet wet in broadcasting as well, and then went from there to
ham
radio.
With Ted too.
Ted, yeah. So
yep. I drowned. I went totally underwater.
Oh, lots of
and
fun.
And couldn't breathe. Anyways, but let's go down this road just for a second.
Sure, go ahead, Ted. No, that's fine.
Let's say we procure one of these little transceivers. They're being sold here at Dayton for under $100.
Yeah.
And this is a dual band.
Ted has got into his hand this little device. It's about the size of a pack of cigarettes, and it's got an antenna on it. It's like a cell phone, a deluxe cell phone, maybe a little thicker.
All right, but anyways, $100. Okay, now what do those antennas sell for? That are the dual Yagi crisscross. You can hold them in your hand.
About the same price.
About $100. So
yeah, about $100
for $200 thereabouts. You could. You could become a satellite
ground station
seeking
like an earth station?
Yes, a ground station.
Well, I guess I was saying you could become a satellite seeking hound is what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
Just like these guys that go out looking for what are those things called? Geocache or something like that. They go around looking. They hunt all over the place for these little hidden things.
Magnetic things. Yes.
Geocache.
There we go. There we are.
Well, they go crazy over that.
Yeah. For a couple of $100, you can get yourself set up. And
so the nice weather coming up.
Absolutely.
You got a ham license. You pick up one of these little radios, the antenna. You go outside. In the summertime, day or night.
Right.
And so what happens? You point this thing in the sky.
Well, the first thing you would want to do is go off to our website and download, if you have a computer, download. We have some free software there for you to download. On the AMSAT website, we have an actual tracking thing that all you do is you put in your latitude and longitude, where you are on the planet, and the time. And then you take a look at this thing, and you just plug in whatever satellite that you want to use, and the frequencies for all of that, frequencies of where to listen, that's all on
our website.
What
if you don't know what satellite? You just say, I just want to talk to somebody.
I just want to talk.
I want to point this thing up in the sky and talk to someone. I don't want it to be a Martian, okay? I want to talk to somebody else on the planet on that satellite.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The schedules and the operational status of all of our satellites are listed on the website. So you can know exactly which satellite, where it is in relation to you, and what the schedule is, and all you just look at the frequency.
What kind of range and what kind of power do you need?
A couple of watts. I
when
normally
you say couple five or ten
couple
watts.
Five, yeah, something like that. With one of those antennas that Ted's mm-hmm. talking about.
And how far can you get from point A to point B?
Well, it's about the footprint of normally these satellites is about the size of the North American continent. And of course, it moves because the satellite's moving. But normally, you can work coast to coast. If you're on the East Coast, if you're really lucky, sometimes you can work through the satellite out over the Atlantic and you can get into Europe. It's a little bit farther on the West Coast going the other way, but normally it's about the size of North America.
And this is through the satellite, and it's not like bouncing your signal off the atmosphere.
Correct. Yeah, we call it an artificial ionosphere. So when the ionosphere is not working, there's the satellite there.
Can you use data modes? For those that have never used this before, a texting or Morse code or voice?
The satellites are built as what we call bent pipes. In other words, whatever you send up to it is what comes down. So that's why we call it a bent pipe. So if you want to send texting modes, in fact, I know D-Star is all the rage now. We've actually had some folks run through one of our satellites, have run D-Star through it. So that can happen. So there's it's the sky's the limit, literally. In this business. It's just that exciting. There's just so many different pieces to it. So
now is it primarily FM, or is there single sideband, or is there any what type of modulation
yes.
modes are there? And
the answer, Ted, is yes. In fact, we have satellites that do FM. We call these the EasySats, and there's information, again, on our website that talks about that. We also have what we call analog or linear transponders that will take sideband and CW. And instead of, unlike a repeater, with the FM satellites, you're basically talking on one channel, and the communications is normally, hello and goodbye, because think of putting your local FM repeater at 500 miles up, and everybody's trying to talk through one channel. It gets kind of crazy. Whereas when we're looking on with a linear satellite transponder, you have a whole band of frequencies, and so it's very much like operating on HF. You just find a spot and you send a CQ or
that's
you
like
answer.
Say if you have like an FM band from 105 to 108,
yeah,
and then you could choose a frequency in there and it'll come down spaced the same way.
Well, it depends on the satellite. The satellites are optimized for either FM or they're optimized for sideband and CW. So we have some satellites that are specifically set up for sideband and CW.
Well, when you were talking about linear, I'm thinking, just like for people who have never done this before, kind of get an understanding. It's like transferring a radio dial.
Pretty much. Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. In fact, you if you go up on the low end of the band, you'll come out on the low end of the band on the downlink.
How much does it cost a ham radio operator to run through a satellite?
Absolutely nothing. It's there. We put them there for all to use. AMSAT, of course, operates strictly as a nonprofit organization. We rely on donations and the assistance of government agencies to help us get our satellites launched. Normally, what we'll do is we'll seek out a launch on a new vehicle that nobody else wants to put their million-dollar satellite on. And we'll go and say, hey, throw us in that briar patch. We'll fly with you, and you'll get to have a real satellite launch. Sometimes we end up in a sub-Atlantic orbit, but a lot of times we get to orbit, and a lot of times it works. So it's like I like to think that we're the Steve Jobs and the Wozniaks of the satellite world, because literally we build stuff in our garages and basements. Mm-hmm. So it's just exciting.
Just another facet of ham radio.
Absolutely. If you get tired, that's the wonderful thing about this hobby. You can be chasing DX, or you can work in contests, or you can, collecting whatever you want to do. You can change modes. If you get tired of something else, you can go do something else. And satellites is just one piece of it.
Is there a regular schedule set up by some of the ham satellite operators, or is it just at random?
It's normally at random. a lot of times you'll run into the same people, oftentimes, but it's pretty much a hit and miss. And it's the same thing with the astronauts and cosmonauts on the International Space Station. Sometimes when they're off duty time, the ISS will come popping up over the horizon. If you've got your radio tuned to their downlink frequency and uplink frequency, you may hear them.
Now, if you go to look, is it amsat.com? You said
amsat.org. AMSAT.org.
Now, what are some of the things that are on the site?
Like I said, there's the tracking, the satellite tracking. There's satellite information about each of our satellites, what it's capable of, what the frequencies are, when it was launched.
You have graphics on there, too.
Oh, yes. There's pictures to show you what the satellite looks like. There's a graphic track of where the satellite is over the Earth that you can follow. If you're interested in going a little bit more, we offer software for donation. Again, we're totally nonprofit. So, but a lot of times it's a labor of love for some of these folks, literally building this stuff.
And well, that was going to be my next question. Where's the financing come from?
It comes from amateur radio operators. And believe it or not, we have amateur radio operators who spend, well, first of all, because the hams themselves are building the spacecraft, all of their time is donated for the most part. So your largest expense for building satellite hardware is labor. And a lot of times we'll use donated leftover parts. In fact, the solar panels that are on our Arisat satellite that's going to be launched out of the International Space Station were donated to us.
About how much, I mean, are you allowed to say, or is even a legitimate way to say, how much does it cost to put in or to put up, like, say, one of the satellites that's up there now?
It depends. If you were...
Let's say material cost.
Well, just to put it together, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, but... Again, in some cases, that's donated. For example, our Arisat satellite that's up on the International Space Station, the Progress launch, it was a cargo launch, was donated. The EVA that will take it outside was donated. So basically, we had solar panels, and we had a battery, and we had a few other things that were donated to us. So it was just the time and effort of the troops to put it together.
If you had to pay for a launch vehicle, how much would that cost?
Millions.
Wow.
Millions. But because
so for no cost,
literal very low cost,
a member of the ham radio community for no cost could work through a satellite whose material cost is hundreds of thousands of dollars. Volunteer,
yeah.
The launch cost is millions of dollars,
and that's
donated. he or she doesn't have to pay a penny.
Yeah, exactly.
What a hobby.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. That's it. That's the fun part. But we have to remember that we're also given access to frequencies that could be sold. And so part of that service aspect of amateur radio is for people to push the state of the art. And one of the places where that's happening is in the amateur satellite world. So in some ways, in many ways, we're helping to justify our continued access to our frequencies as well.
Well, you touched on an interesting subject there. Ted, I don't know if you had talked about it or not, too, but everybody is always looking for spectrum space to put all kinds of everything from cell phones, the computer, the wireless and Wi-Fi and stuff like that. And you literally have to justify that use, a use it or lose it type of thing.
Correct.
And we've heard that for years. We've seen those frequencies literally chopped away. In fact, the one of the most popular ham radio bands between 420 and 450 megahertz is under scrutiny now to see if that should be sold off. Again, it's like to the highest bidder, rather than reserving some of that for the public service aspect, the service, the emergency communications provided at no cost by ham radio operators.
Absolutely. And one of the things that the American Radio League and other people are holding up is the fact that, hey, wait a minute, there's some pushing the state of the art forward being done in that band, and it's being done by organizations like ours.
If we didn't have ham radio frequencies, how many things wouldn't have happened by now?
That's exactly correct. And in fact, you could also say that a lot of what we take for granted, like geostationary TV satellites, for example, a lot of that technology, in fact, another classic example is Iridium. The Iridium constellation, the Globalstar, you know, the satellite, the low-Earth satellite telephones, all of that technology came right out of the ham bands. It came out of the work that a lot of the folks that are standing over here at this booth today were responsible
for. Well, just the idea of cell phones being, you were talking about duplex transmissions with ham radio, where you talk and listen at the same time instead of just one way at a time, like somebody would do on CB or something if they're not familiar with ham radio. That came out of the research done by hobbyists.
Absolutely. Well, and you could say that Marconi was an amateur. Mm-hmm. I mean, really.
Well, you know, the other thing is that we have TC over IP,
yes.
TCP over IP communications going on, and that was invented by
a couple
of hams.
All of those protocols came right out of the ham bands. Yeah.
And of course, without that, at this point, you wouldn't even be hearing us at all. Because that's
in many ways, that's true.
Because this signal travels by means of internet to Monticello, Maine, and without that, of course, it wouldn't be happening.
Yeah.
But you look at the ingenuity of hams. I mean, I would say that there's probably so many more things that are in our world from a technological standpoint, where maybe hams didn't develop the whole thing, but they developed the core principle that someone else has picked up on and said, hey, let's use this out in the commercial arena, or let's market this, or whatever. I mean, there's no telling how much is there. I don't think people realize.
It's mind-boggling when you start to think about a lot of the things that we take for granted and in our world and where they had their roots, and the fact that a lot of that came right out of the amateur radio world. It's just phenomenal.
Well, some of the greatest discoveries in mankind's history has been the lone scientist working in his basement. You can still do that every day with ham radio, whether it's traditional, whether it's using some classic equipment, whether it's finding new uses for new pieces of equipment, a line of code somewhere that nobody had ever come up with for a computer. It's still the individual.
Well, not only that, but a lot of the some of the parts that have gone into our satellites have been bought in the Dayton flea market. So it works both ways.
We're here at Dayton now, the biggest flea market in the world.
A lot of our things have come out of warehouses and basements and garages. And I know there's some pieces that went onto our Phase 3D satellite, which was launched back in early 2000. Came right out of the flea market right here at Dayton.
So that's up in space right now.
It's in orbit right now. Came right out of the flea market.
Well, you know, and you consider that what's out there on the flea market came out of somebody's garage and somebody's basement. So, I mean, it's like it's come full circle.
Somebody has said that if you can't find it at Dayton, it was never made. And that probably fits.
That's it, yeah. I mean, I've heard several people at the flea market today bragging to others, saying, is the first time Dayton? Yeah, well, if you can't find it in Dayton, it isn't there, at least the source of it.
And the other rule is, if you see something, you better buy it, because if you come back, it's going to be gone.
Well, some of the things that are out there now, too, it's like you get little chips and parts for like 5 cents, 10 cents,
amazing.
Things like that.
Yeah. Just amazing.
Incredible hobby. Yeah.
Incredible hobby. Anyway, wonderful work, Ted. Appreciate what you're doing.
Now let me ask a question. Are you guys done chatting now?
I'm sorry. I know we've stolen your show.
See what
here,
you did, Ted. You invited another broadcaster to come along.
I've been
with
enjoying
a big
this. Matter of fact, well, no. Let me tell you what. You've been giving me some ideas here. I need to maybe farm some things out to you, because really, this show, doing a 2-hour show every week and then trying to get it.
You've got a lot of time to fill.
You know, and you get up on iTunes, and I'll tell you. You're a fantastic guest. You're a great guest. Sometimes I'm not that blessed. I mean, someone will sit down and I'll say, I understand you're into amateur radio satellites. And they'll say, yep. Well, can you tell me about it a little bit? And they'll say, well, they're on up there.
Yeah, there they are. They come around every 90 minutes.
So you get the 3-word answers, and and I think sometimes people do that because they get nervous. Some people are just nervous about talking into a microphone.
Well, that's true. Of course,
ham radio operators shouldn't be nervous talking into a microphone.
Well, but you'd be surprised how many are.
Well, you mentioned broadcast transmitters as opposed to ham.
Well,
still radio.
They're just not used to
it. Stop and think about the number of hams you know. And how many hams actually really get on the air and talk? because there are those that buy the equipment, it's all set up. They might make an occasional contact or something like that, but they're not regularly on the air.
Or their style of broadcasting or their style of operating is to work a DX station, and it's, you know, signal report and how are you and goodbye and you know, put it in the log. And which is another part of the hobby. I mean, that's the nice part about this, is that if that's all you want to do, you can do that.
Well, see, what we're doing right now is we have a transmitter sitting there on, what, 9330 right now? Is right. That where we're on? And it's turned on, and it's transmitting, and everybody's listening, but it's one way at a time. Ham radio is two-way. You transmit, and then somebody else transmits back to you. You communicate, you interact with each other. It's a whole different way of looking at things. Hams don't broadcast, so to speak. Hams communicate.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly what we do. And it's a wonder, like you said, it's a wonderful hobby. Anyway.
I was going to say, we have another chair here. I would like to welcome this gentleman to sit down. And
I'm going to go ahead and scoot, because
right.
I've got work
Keith,
to do.
Keith, I really appreciate you
coming.
Oh,
my pleasure, Ted. I appreciate what you're doing, because is really spreading the word, and it's fantastic. I know it's a labor of love. It's probably a lot of work. But
it's a considerable amount of work, but one of the things that we're finding with international shortwave radio, and that is it's probably the absolute best area for perspective ham radio operators, you know, guys that are listening to HF.
Shortwave listeners.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of the...
They've got an interest in it.
That's,
you know,
it. Anyway, if you need me, if you want to have me on your show or to talk more about ham radio satellites, be more than happy to help you out.
I've got your card now.
Yeah, so I'm in trouble now.
I'll be giving you a call.
He's got my number. Take care, Ted. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Keith. And there's a gentleman standing here that I think is going to be real interesting to talk to on the air for a number of different reasons. And I'm going to let him introduce himself as soon as he can put the headphones on and get up on that microphone and say hello to everyone and tell them who you are and what you're doing right now.
Okay, hello, Ted. I'm James O'Neill. I'm a retired broadcast engineer, and for the last 6 years, I've been technology editor for TV Technology Magazine. I do a lot of writing for Radio World, some other publications about the radio broadcasting business. Oddly enough, I spent almost 37 years in television engineering, but my first love was radio. I've always loved radio, the power of radio, what you can do with a very simple transmitter, very simple receiver. You can do things globally. Just a fantastic, fantastic experience and ride I've had in radio.
I'm going to ask you to get a little closer.
Okay.
And the reason why is you got a conversation going on in back of you, and they're it's a contest.
I didn't want to work the mic too closely.
These are Heil PR40s, they're great mics, and you don't have to worry. But now, your background in radio, I recall seeing some videos up on YouTube. And I'm trying to think. Were you not involved in those videos?
I don't believe so.
You don't think so? Okay, now I'm trying to think. And maybe you were quoted there. I don't know, but there was a thing on VOA that was up there.
Okay, I know what you're talking about. Yes, I did a story for Radio World. Oh, this was 2007. The Delano, what I want to call the relay station. The organization now calls them transmitter plants, transmitter stations. Was being shut down. This was the last of the three wartime VOA transmission plants, relay stations, that was constructed. One being in Bethany, another being in Dixon, Northern California, and the Delano plant near Bakersfield in Southern California. And I did a story for Radio World that was picked up, used on a video on the Internet as an effort to try to save the facility, since it is really an historic site. It was built under wartime emergencies, shortages, manpower, material, both. But they got this station on the air, including a 200,000-watt HF transmitter, in time to do some broadcasting into the Pacific Theater, try to reach the Japanese, reach our troops there, give them some morale, give them news from home, tell the truth. Don't listen to Tokyo Rose or Axis Sally. You know, the VOA is going to tell the truth. That's why the plants were built. It was just a fantastic engineering project, because nobody had built transmitting, shortwave transmitting plants this big in this country and probably anywhere else at the time. So that's the story you're talking about, which was picked up by Mike DeRoe. and put on the internet.
Okay, now I guess the thing that I was wanting to address is the fact that you had a background in this, an extensive background in it. And I think one of the reasons why is because you used to work for the VOA.
Right, I did. I spent a little over 30 years with the organization, not in the radio side of things. And this is what a lot of people don't realize, but there's a television side also. It is now called VOA TV, which I think is a horrible oxymoron, voice television. But nonetheless, that's what it's called. Most of the time I was there, actually I went to work in 1975 for the U.S. Information Agency's Television and Motion Picture Service. In 1984, we started our first full-time satellite-delivered television service globally, and that was dubbed WorldNet. So the most of the time I was there, it was either USI Television or WorldNet. But now it is VOA TV, and it is still a very, very big entity, a very large part of the Voice of America organization. I can't speak from them. I've been retired for 6 years, so I'm not speaking officially. I'm just giving you some history.
I recall when I was younger, much younger, tuning in late at night and listening to the Voice of America and listening them to it. I don't know who did this show. It seems like there may have been different hosts at different times, but they had a show on called The Breakfast Show. Mm-hmm. I mean, they simply called it The Breakfast Show. And they played everything under the sun. I mean, they would play a piece of classical music. They would play and they may have played a Loretta Lynn song. And then do a jazz piece or a top 40 piece. It was just all over the place. It was a complete cross section of any music that you could possibly want to hear. And then they laced that in with celebrities that were that they could do interviews with. And I mean, it could be a sports figure, it could be an actor, it could be somebody. Generally, it was somebody that was in the news for one reason or another. It was the most compelling radio program I think I've ever heard in my life. And I wondered, I thought, why would anyone want to stop that kind of broadcasting? Because it portrayed our entire culture. In other words, it showed the music we listened to, it showed our lifestyle, it showed a bit of our philosophy in terms of what it was really like to live in the United States. And I don't know, I thought it was just outstanding. You know, and I don't know, I guess that program went by the wayside somewhere.
Right. The television operation was moved from a separate building into the building with the radio side of things in 1997. And about the only vestige I saw of this breakfast show was a cart they used to carry, move tapes and audio recordings, records, down the halls from the library to the studio where the show originated. But there was still a cart. I'd see it in the hall with other things on it, and it was slugged, the breakfast club show. Another host that he's long since gone was Willis Conover. Did you listen to Willis and his jazz program?
Yes, I recall that. And I not only did I hear him live, but I've also heard some recordings of him as well.
And again, long gone. Nobody picked up the slack. It's gone. Hopefully, not too forgotten about. But we need to be doing more things like
what
this.
What classic delivery, though? I mean, that guy. He when he came on, it was like he was fully in control. He was. How would you say it? Very polished. In other words, you felt like you were listening to a professional. You felt like the guy was really extending himself professionally on the air to you as the listener. You didn't feel like that you had just tuned into some greenhorn, you know, that was just
no, these people were top professionals. You had, at one time back in the 60s, Edward R. Murrow, who had left CBS to come in and run the whole U.S. Information Agency, and he brought a number of really, really good people in. I'm thinking not somebody as an air performer, but a writer, producer, director, and this was William N. Robeson. If you've ever listened to Suspense, the classic radio shows, you know the name William N. Robeson. I got a chance to meet Bill Robeson one day, spent an afternoon with him early on in my career there. So you had some top-notch, and you still have some top-notch people there. Don't get me wrong.
Tell me a little bit, what was the major difference or distinction between VOA television and VOA radio in terms of its philosophy and its approach and how it was done?
Well, the television, again, I don't go back that far. I came in 1975, and the building, the Patrick Henry Building facility, had just been built a couple of years in operation. But they'd been doing television since the early 60s in one form or another. Now, the problem being very difficult to do international television broadcasting without communication satellites, which didn't exist for television, or if they did, they were prohibitively expensive and very limited in transponder capacity back in the early 60s. So the what we referred to as our transmitter room, when I started in 1975, was a videotape recording area for making copies of programs in NTSC, either color or monochrome, or if the country that we were trying to reach, trying to get placement in, was not an NTSC 525 line standard company, we would do kinescopes, television film recordings. I thought that was long since gone, but when I walked in 1975, and we had a very viable kinescope operation. We had three kinescope machines, one color, two black and white, and these stayed fairly busy, making copies of our programs to be played around the world. As I said later, funding came through during During the Reagan administration, we had quite an interesting director, Charlie Wick, who got funding for the first time to do a satellite full-time broadcast network, to implement a network like this. And that's how we started out. Again, we did some news, but not much. That ended fairly soon. But we did a lot of cultural shows. I'm recalling dance troupes, musical performers, shows of general interest like this, and setting up, trying to reach the world, trying to put out something that people would watch. Now they're doing a tremendous amount of news with television, at least they were when I left in 2005, and have even added more. So there's a very close synergy now between the radio and television side.
Now, I guess the only thing that I find, I guess if I want to say I find fault, okay, is the back burnering and the, I guess I want to say, devaluation of shortwave radio. It, to me, in my opinion, shows a complete and total short-sightedness upon the part of the people making the decisions. Because one thing we know for sure, and we know this by means of email and by letters and things that come in, shortwave is bigger today than it was 20 years ago by far. There are thousands more people that are being reached. I mean, I remember going on radio on shortwave, started a program on when George McClintock first launched WWCR, and we started a program called Worldwide Country. And we get mail. Okay, well, it takes time to get mail. Back then, there was no email. There was no such thing as email, okay? Now, I go on the radio, and within an hour and a half of getting behind the microphone and making the plea or saying, if you want to hear a song, send us your email. 500, 600, 700 emails in the space of an hour, hour and a half. You got an email server that is basically gonna croak if this volume doesn't stop. We've actually seen the email server come down and crash from it and all that. You know, and the thing of it is I'll tell you, I know this for a fact. A Chicago FM radio station, a major Chicago FM radio station, and I use either Chicago, I could say Atlanta, I could say Los Angeles, could not generate 700 emails in an hour if their life depended on it. It couldn't happen. But yet all the credibility is placed there. And it's kind of like a propaganda that we've had that launched in the United States of America. And I know you're probably thinking, I know you're smiling at me back over here, you know, you're probably thinking, oh, this guy, he's crazy. He's talking crazy. No, I'm not. I mean, this is something I've witnessed myself. And yet I see organizations saying, well, we're going to drop our shortwave facilities. We just don't know if there's, you know, anybody listening to it. Well, you know, you got to put something on the air that's compelling. You've got to put something on the air that people want to hear, you know. And shortwave today, to be honest with you, you know, it's for the most part, it's either complete, total religion, or you've got, you know, somebody preaching 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Or you've got people trying to sell and market gold on there. Or you've got people that the Chicken Little, the sky is falling, it's all coming to an end. You better get your dehydrated food, and you better buy your water filters, because everything's coming to an end. You know, and that's the kind of programming. So, and people are still buying the radios and listening to it. So when you put something on like an oldie show, or you put some decent music on, or you put some decent talk programming on, you've got an audience. I mean, one big audience, you know. So I don't know, but anyways, that's my tirade for today.
Well, I couldn't really agree more. I'm not going to use call letters, but I've got to tell you this story. This was a couple of months ago. I was at the transmitter site for a 50,000 watt AM broadcast station, and the operator there was showing me they're running a new solid state transmitter, but they had an older tube type Continental as a backup. And he was showing me how quickly he could transition from the main transmitter to the backup transmitter to this 50,000 watt radio station. And he did, and I noticed, I said, look, Dave, if I'm reading this right, you're only running about 13,000 watts into the antenna on the backup. He said, yeah. I said, nobody's listening anyway, because the station was carrying federal government news. I will use a caller to WFED, which used to be WTOP in Washington. And I said, you know, if you put the news back on the station, the news went, this all news format, it's a fantastic news format there in Washington. If you put this back on the AM, people would go, the ratings would go through the ceiling like they do with it on FM. It's all about programming. It's not so much about the signal delivery, it's about the programming, and I couldn't agree more. You put the right sort of programming, no matter what band it is, AM, FM, shortwave, people are going to listen, you're going to get response.
Well, that's one thing that I really liked about VOA, and that was is that the programming that went out on VOA was, it exceeded what we got domestically in most of our major markets. I mean, you had some real pros. And the level of quality of programming was just outstanding. I mean, that breakfast show, and I can think of a few other programs, I can't think of names, but you were talking about the jazz presentation, the jazz show, just incredible. I mean, I think that's where it's at. It's all in how much work are you willing to do in order to put something together that people are going to want to hear. And it is work.
And it wasn't just drama. It wasn't just music. It was drama. That's why William Robeson was hired, because he had such a reputation. The guy had won something like 6 or 7 Peabody's.
Oh, yeah.
And won another one for a series he did on the VOA dramatizing the bicentennial events. This was 1976. So, again, it's all about programming.
And that's, I guess I want to say, I think that's the key factor in the success of any radio station, and I think that's one of the things that has literally hurt the AM and FM industry across the country, is the fact that, you know, we have the programming pretty well there has got on a back burner. It's become a budget item, you know, and before it never used to be the budget. It never used to be the budget item, you know, but it's the budget item now. And by putting that on the back burner, you're basically putting the listeners on the back burner at the same time.
Well, that's another one of my rants, too, what's happened to AM radio in this country with this audio processing, this over-processing, this limited bandwidth thing they're doing to accommodate HD. You've got a small percentile of people listening to HD on an AM station, but you're penalizing everyone else who's listening with an AM receiver. I've done an editorial about that. It really, really galls me to even try to listen to some of these stations for a long period of time because of this horrendous amount of processing you're doing.
Well, I went to, I forget where I went to, David. What was the city we went to visit your friend from overseas? It was in Ohio. He can't think. Anyways, I was close into, and I'll just use this, it was near Youngstown or up in that neck of the woods. And I tuned in on the radio. I was wanting to hear CKLW out of Windsor. You know, I just wanted to hear the station. And I tuned it in, and at 800 kilohertz, I had white noise. Just a hash, just psh, constant. And it was some IBOC station running IBOC 20 KCs away, you know. And I got to thinking, since when has the FCC got to where they'll allow that sort of trash on the air to cover up another station's signal? I mean, obviously, there's a way probably to do digital broadcasting on AM, but you don't have to generate garbage, 20 kilohertz, 30 kilohertz, either side of the main carrier. That just seems unreasonable.
I could not agree more. I'm a broadcast band DXer as well as a shortwave listener, and there's so many stations which are just not there anymore. I used to enjoy listening to WHO on 1040 out of Des Moines from my home there in Northern Virginia. But WBZ, 10:30, they lit up, and WHO is gone forever, at least until they turn their exciter off.
I used to listen to Mike Hoyer on WHO. Mike Hoyer was on at night, did a truck driving show. And then, of course, you enjoyed the programming like WBZ. There was Larry Glick on WBZ that you could listen to at night. Yeah. I want to say hello. This fellow's been sitting here so patiently, and I want to talk to him. He goes. Have you seen him with a hat on and running around the hamvention with a hat on?
I've seen the hat, yes.
He's here every year. And I also have run into you in Huntsville, I believe, as well.
Yes.
So, anyways, why don't you go ahead, go on the air here, and introduce yourself, tell us who you are and what you do, and explain the hat, please.
Well, Ted, I'm Joe, and Joe Eisenberg. And
we've talked before, incidentally, yes. So I know I've...
And I'm K0NEB from Lincoln, Nebraska, and this is my 32nd trip to Hamvention. And the reason for the hat is so my friends can find me in the crowd. I missed one year, and when I came back the next year, I had a baseball cap on. And they said, well, we missed you 2 years in a row. So I decided, well, maybe there's something wrong. They can't find my frequency or something. So one of them said, well, maybe you need a bigger hat. And so a couple months later, I saw these at the Nebraska State Fair and decided, I think I can do this. And a year later, I decided, okay, that shtick was done. I left it in the car. And I walked in, and everybody said, where's the hat? So I couldn't move in this place without people asking for the hat. So I said, okay, I went back out to the car, put the hat on. It's been a tradition ever since. So I've worn it for about 15 years. Now, what I do here is I'm a speaker. I present on kit building. I teach hams all about the world of radio kits. And as you know, Heathkit was a mainstay of amateur radio for many years. And when they went away, a lot of people thought, well, kit building is a lost art. So I took it upon myself to start teaching seminars on how to build kits and finding sources of new kits. And several new companies came up with brand new solid-state simple kits, and pretty soon it's built up again to the point where you have like Elecraft, you have Hendrix kits, Tentec kits. There's a zillion different kits out there on the market now. And there's a whole batch of new amateurs that have never had a soldering iron in their hand.
I can recall when I was a kid, you could get your hands on old television chassis, and you could create just about anything out of one of those. Once you got done clipping the parts off of five or six of them, then you had yourself a whole bunch of tubes. You had tube sockets. You had high voltage transformers, rectifiers. And with that, you could just about make anything you decided you wanted to make. But today, that's just not there. It's not so. But if a person knows what they're doing, they can, they can assemble enough of the newer solid-state parts and basically do almost the same thing as we could with our old television chassis.
But now, what's interesting is that one kit that I've built fits in an Altoids tin, and it's a 40-meter CW transceiver. Runs on a 9-volt battery, and I've made contacts all the way as far east as New York from Nebraska.
So you've talked to New York from Nebraska in CW, and you've done this with a not a transmitter, but a transceiver, means it both transmits and receives, and it fits inside of a tuna fish tin.
It's an Altoids tin.
I'm sorry. I'm thinking of the tuna thing that they were... Altoids is even smaller.
That's right.
Okay, so... All right, so now... that just doesn't seem like that's real.
Under $30.
Does that seem like it's real to you? I mean,
with this technology we've got, it's fantastic. I started in the tube-type era of broadcast gear, where you'd have a rack, basically, and you could, you know, fit that in something you can hold in the palm of your hand now. It's microelectronics, absolutely fantastic, what you can put in a very small space. But you were talking about kit building. I've got to throw this in. One of my best memories is getting a night kit ocean hopper and assembling that. And
the regenerative receiver.
Right, I had a shortwave set. It was a cast-off Philco AM receiver with one shortwave band that somebody had given me when I was a kid. But I said, I want to hear more. So this thing had the plug-in coils. It covered the whole HF spectrum and then some. So, I it worked the first time I turned it on, which was remarkable.
Well, the way I got...
I was about 10.
The way I got started was my father bought me what you see on my shirt, rocket radio. And do you know what a rocket radio
is? Yes.
Was?
Now,
it was,
you know,
a little crystal set.
That is something that most people don't know. These things look like a little plastic rocket. They're red.
Yeah.
And then the very top the nose cone was, as you pull a slider, it would slide out.
It was a slug tuner.
Right, there was a ferrite core slug tuner. Yep. And this is how
and then you know what got me, though, was there was a crystal headphone, but there was an alligator clip.
Yeah.
And the inside the information, it said to put that on ground, to ground that somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And I've often wondered about that. How did that work? Because it didn't have an antenna. You know, there was no antenna. You were clipping it onto ground. And I thought, how did that work? But it worked. I mean, you could slide that thing. And I lived in the Detroit area. So I could hear, at that time, it was WKMH. I could hear CKLW, WWJ, and WXYZ. And all these stations would come in.
See, I listened to WOW and KFAB and KOIL with it in Omaha. Growing up, and it was incredible. And by the way, you were talking earlier about the problem with iBox stations. With crystal sets, it's more difficult to listen because the white noise that's generated from KFAB in Omaha makes it difficult to hear other stations on the band. You can hear KFAB on a crystal set, but the stations adjacent to it, you cannot hear.
They're
on
gone.
One.
They're gone.
Because it covers it up. And the other thing you talked about brought back memories, and that is the breakfast show. People couldn't figure out why at night on a Hallicrafters S120 I was listening to a breakfast show. Where are they having breakfast? So I had to explain there's time differences around the world.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
but after I showed interest with the rocket radio and my father brought home a Hallicrafters general coverage receiver, our family friend Leo Meyerson, who started World Radio, taught me amateur radio. And by the time I was 14, I got my ham license. And my Elmer had just passed away recently. He was 100 years old and was an absolute pioneer in the world of radio. And that was Leo Meyerson, W0, Get Fat Quick.
And he started World Radio. Is that
World Radio Labs.
Okay, then that
Council
they were
Bluffs.
Okay, I had, at one point, a transmitter. It was a Globe Champ 300, and it ran a pair of 9909s in the final. And stupid kid, I sold it, got rid of it or something. But I always wanted that thing back because that was, I think that was the best sounding AM transmitter I had ever owned.
I can't remember the modulation scheme they used on it, but it sounded absolutely high fidelity. And their Globe Chief would do the same thing.
Okay, I've never had one of those, but the Globe Champ 300, and I know there's a Globe Champ 500, I think.
Mm-hmm. And there was a Globe Chief and a Globe Scout.
And but I haven't seen one of those things. The Globe Champ 300, I haven't seen one since I got rid of the one I had. I mean, I've not seen one on eBay. I've not seen one, like, at the Dayton Hamvention here. You won't see. I don't know why. I guess people that have them hang on to them. It must be, because you just don't see them.
I bought one, this is about 7 years ago, and it's tucked away in a closet. It's waiting restoration. It's in pretty sad condition.
A 300?
Not the 300, the Scout.
Well, see, that's what I mean. You won't find any of the...
But I haven't seen much of this lineage of receiver, of transmitter, around at all.
Well, you'll see a lot of the Johnson Viking 2s, and you'll see Heathkit DX100s and all that kind of thing, which is the same vintage. And I guess it's probably about the same kind of thing.
Well, the unique thing that Leo brought to kit building and ham radio was, at the same point where Heathkit was selling kits, he decided to sell a kit where the wiring was already pre-cut. The wires were already cut to length and stripped and tinned and ready to go. And he would sell a $55 kit for $5 down and $5 a month just to get people into amateur radio.
That's amazing. Well, you know, kit building, what one thing, like I said, today, it's not as practical as it was years ago, like when you collected the old television chassis and you'd snip all the resistors and caps off and things. Can't do that today. You got circuit boards, surface mount, all this stuff. I mean, where are you going to collect parts? But with
we have kits that are made with surface mount now, and you actually put them on the board yourself if you'd like. And well, there's ways to do it.
But what I'm saying is with a kit, the kit removes that challenge, which today I think is impractical and probably impossible to be able to go out and, you know, and collect enough random parts to actually build something from scratch. But when you have a kit situation, all the parts are there. Everything you need is there. And it just, to me, that's all that does is basically save you the headache and the heartache of having to go try to find. Because it was always the kind of thing when you went to build something, you've got to do a homebrew project. You get everything together, and all of a sudden you realize you're missing two parts. And those two parts were the hardest things in the world to ever locate. I remember trying to substitute, you know, getting the old tube substitution manual out and saying, what else can I put in here?
And you could change different resistor values to accommodate the different tubes.
Yep.
So by the same token, how many radio stores, parts stores, parts houses are left that would have parts like this for the kids of today, young people, to come up and actually build something from scratch?
It's almost impossible.
It
I know Radio Shack just has a smattering of parts.
I don't think they want to do that. I think they're trying to discourage that.
Yeah. But, although, lately, actually today, I just got an email from them that they're trying to encourage DIY people again. But I don't see them carrying the quantity of stuff like they used to, where I knew that I could get a 33 microfarad capacitor walking into a Radio Shack store. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. And so in most cities, there's no place to go. So you have to order it mail order. So there isn't that spontaneity in homebrewing anymore. But kits that are already, all the parts are selected and put together for you have become quite popular again. Where when Heathkit went out, a lot of people mourned the loss of well-documented kits. Now they come out, and not only are they well done, you don't have all these addendum sheets anymore that Heathkit used to put in their manuals, because when they sell you a kit, they just say, go online to our website and download the manual. So the latest version, the latest revision is always online, and you print your own manual, so there's always updates available.
Have you noticed, though, one thing? If you get on eBay and you find an unbuilt Heathkit,
oh wow!
The price tag on those things is just through the roof.
Well, you know, in the February and April issues of CQ Magazine this year, I went through the process of actually building a 32-year-old Heathkit signal generator and showing what the differences were. And so many people told me, you ruined a perfectly good, sealed, unbuilt Heathkit. And I had others that wrote into me, and I got dozens of emails from people saying, my God, you sure brought back memories, and I'm going to go looking for those things.
Well, they're out there, but as you say, you will pay through the nose for them.
Oh, yes. Yeah. They're very expensive.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I can recall not just Heathkit, but at that point in time, there was Nightkit.
Yes.
And you built
and Lafayette.
The
Ico kits.
And Lafayette. Right.
But now you built the Ocean Hopper, which was a night kit.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was regenerative, wasn't it?
That was a regenerative receiver with plug-in coils to change bands. And that was one of the trademarks about Knight, Allied Radio Corporation's Knight kit division. The wires were cut and stripped. They're cut to length. You had so many purple wires, so many yellow wires, green wires, so on and so forth, all different lengths. And the manual would say very explicitly, connect but do not solder one end of a green wire to pin 7 of tube V5.
Exactly. And Globe did the same thing, but Heathkit was the biggest, but they didn't do that. They just gave you spools of wire, and you had to cut them, measure them, strip them, and tin them yourself. So that's how the other companies were able to compete. And to me, I'm so excited that there's so many neat new kits coming. Every year when I put on the kit building forum here, there's always at least a half a dozen really significant new kits on the horizon. So there's always stuff for me to write about every month.
One of the other things, I don't want to take this too far, but one of the things that always intrigued me once I got a few years on me was looking back at the people who designed these kits. They never really got credit. You don't know who designed. In your case, you do, but I'm saying Knight, Heath, you really don't know who designed the things. And you think about what a challenge this was, because you're working not with the best, most expensive components. Some of these are even military surplus. That's how Heath kit started out, I understand. So you're working not with the real top-notch components. I know I had one kit, Allied. It used imported tubes before people were importing tubes over here, just to save a few pennies in quantity. And also, you've got the people who are putting these kits together who have really varying levels of expertise and proficiency at even soldering, much less debugging or finding mistakes. Yet, and I won't say invariably, but in most cases, these kits work or could be made to work fairly easily. So I think there are a lot of unsung heroes out there. Unfortunately, I guess most of them have passed on. But I really would like to try to do something someday in terms of saluting these engineering people, these designers who came up with these kit circuits.
Yeah, every once in a while I run into one. I know there's a member of the radio club in Omaha that I saw last week, and he talked at the meeting about how he used to design for Heath Kit, and he wasn't a ham until 5 years ago, but yet he designed many amateur radio products. So it's you're right. There's this hidden cadre of technical minds that came up with the ideas for these kits. Nowadays, they're pretty well known. There's several individuals that are known as kit designers. But back then, they were just kind of hidden behind the front door of Heath Kit or Lafayette or Ico or all the other big kit manufacturers. The nice thing is that nowadays we have temperature-controlled soldering stations that are inexpensive right behind you. A booth sells them for $40. If you get the right kind of solder, good tips and stuff, and the right tools, I can pretty well get anybody to build a kit. And once they've built one, they'll build more. And that's what's neat, because the thing that I try to emphasize is once you've built a kit, you can modify the kit. You can improve on the design. That's the idea. And so it's a lot of fun. If the volume control doesn't work right, we'll change the value of the pot, change the bias resistor on the amplifier. There's all sorts of things you can do to a kit that you wouldn't really want to do to another one, a commercially built radio, because you don't have the access to the board.
Well, the other thing is the kit takes away the fear. You're inside a bunch of parts that you've soldered together yourself, following instructions. And then if you kind of gather a little bit as to how the circuit operates, it kind of encourages that experimentation, thinking, well, you know what? I'd like a little bit more gain in this circuit. Or maybe I think there's too much gain in this circuit, you know. And so you start playing around with values. And you begin to see, well, I thought if I increased the value of that resistor, the gain would go down, but it didn't. How come? You know, and it starts to become an educational process in itself. I don't know. Do you think I'm...
Well, no, that's something that was very good, at least about most of the kits that I built. There was always a theory of operation somewhere in the manual. So you had sort of a feel for what was happening stage by stage throughout these circuits that you were putting together sort of mindlessly. You connect wire, purple wire to pin 7, as I said. That's sort of a mindless thing. I mean, some people I know did just look at a schematic and build, but not recommended. But there was a theory of operation, so you knew what was really happening circuit by circuit area.
That's kind of the way I learned a lot of my electronics was
exactly,
from building
same
kits.
Here. Same here.
And back then, they had these 50-in-1 kits that aren't like the little cube ones like they are today. They had little terminals, and you pushed your transistor leads through and resistor leads through these little spring terminals. And
you could build all these different things.
Build all these different things, and then you could say, hey, I wonder what I could do, and you don't have to unsolder it. You just loosen it up, put another wire in there, and away it worked. Well, I have to go, but before I go, I wanted to tell you, I do listen to you on shortwave on 7415. It sounds wonderful in Nebraska, and I listen to your songs in the evening.
Well, I'll tell you, it's what's been just crazy is we've started doing this love songs thing on Saturday night. You know how this started? I started doing oldies.
Yeah.
Started doing oldies. And a friend of mine started making some suggestions, and I started listening to the suggestions, and I thought, well, I don't know. But anyways, what happened was this. There was a fellow, I'll never forget, he was in Colorado, and he said something to the effect in an email. Her name was Susan. The year was 1963 or whatever it was. And I fell deeply in love with her, and I haven't seen her or have lost track of her. But she's never left my mind and heart, and I have no idea where she is today. But then you played that song tonight and totally destroyed my evening. It brought back too many memories, okay? And so I got to thinking about that. Well, I thought, you know, music does touch everybody's life. It's something, I mean, somewhere, you know, there's a song that you remember from when you were a teenager.
And you associate it with a specific event or person.
Yeah.
Exactly. In fact, that's why I also do the slideshows for the Dayton Hamvention. If you go to YouTube and look up my call sign, K0NEB, you'll see my channel, and I have a whole set of slideshows. And people tell me that the songs I use to synchronize the pictures and go with the words of the songs changes their image of that song forever. And when they drive in their car and they hear that song on the radio, they remember my picture of the lady over there in that booth, and they remember the picture of you, and they remember the picture of the new radios and stuff. And it brings back memories of Dayton. So people really key on certain songs. And so it's always fun to pick a song and make my slideshow with it.
Well, there's certain songs, I'm absolutely certain, that trigger memories. Matter of fact, I was working for a radio station. I won't name the call sign. But I actually was able to effectively get the ratings to go up a couple points by taking summertime songs and rotating them heavier in the summertime, wintertime songs, rotating them heavier in the wintertime. And the reason why is because when you hear that song that was released in the winter, you think about something that happened during the winter. And the same thing with summer. It was a hot day outside, and the sun was beating down, and they were playing the Lovin' Spoonful of... What is it?
Summer in the City.
Yeah, Summer in the City. It was going around the head, but it wasn't quite stopped yet. You know, that song is indicative of that kind of thing, and it produces that kind of feeling. You know?
That's an unusual song, too, because I don't know whether you know this or not.
Joe, calling me. But thank you for coming by here. Appreciate it.
And I've written into your show many times.
Oh, I appreciate that. And you be sure to come back and visit with us again sometime.
You bet.
Okay. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, Summer in the City, I heard this story several different places, so I'm assuming it's true. But I understand that when they were recording this, we had the session going, they actually brought a retired radio sound effects man out of retirement to come in and do the sound effects, the jackhammer, these other sounds that are part of this Summer in the City of the Lovin' Spoonful.
Yeah.
But my great summer song, I always, I hear this instantly. I go back to summer when I was a young teenager, Nat King Cole, Roll Out Those Lazy, Hazy, Crazy Days of Summer.
Oh, yeah.
The drive-in and the pretzels and so on and so forth.
Well, I guess I was going to ask you this, I don't want to beleaguer the point on VOA, but where does VOA radio stand now? I mean, as far as shortwave, are they going to shut down Greenville too now, or is that have they knocked Delano down?
Is it Delano? As far as I know, the building, the facility is still there. I really can't speak officially. I've been gone almost 6 years, been retired. I have a few friends. I keep a few connections going.
Well, I'm not asking you to
speak
officially. I just don't know how much you might still know, or maybe what you've heard, you know, as far as...
Well, I did a story for Radio World as recently was printed. I was down last fall with the editor of Radio World, Paul McLean, and did a photo essay. Showing the equipment, showing the facility off at VOA Greenville, Site B. Site A is gone. It was speculated in the article that Site B may not survive the end of this fiscal year, which is the end of September. We don't know. I'm trying to be optimistic. I would like to see it going forever. But the station has been really, really scaled down. At one time, there were two, and it's still the biggest radio broadcasting facility in the country in terms of transmitters and antennas. It's still a very large facility, but it has been scaled back tremendously over the last several years. And, of course, a number of VOA plants have gone down completely, like Bethany, Delano, Dixon, overseas plants. Morocco, the presence in Germany is not there. I have some great memories. I went out and visited some of these plants, seeing these very, very large transmitters. And it saddens me because, as you know, this is a very viable part of the spectrum. It's the only part of the spectrum where you can do global communications without satellites. And I really think it's being used a lot more than it is, and I really hate to see international broadcasting go. A story to tell, I had a sister in Northern California I went to visit the first time. This was in the early, in the mid-70s. And this community she lived in was totally white in terms of radio signals during the daytime. There was nothing that came in AM or FM. It was down on a hole, mountains wrapping around it. Somebody had bootlegged television in by putting an antenna on top of one of the ridges and bringing some transmission line down, but that's all they had. The only time they got radio was at night. So one of the first things I did when I got back home, I bought a shortwave receiver and sent it to her and instructed her in how to use it so you had some sort of radio coming in during the daytime, even though it wasn't local, of course.
Well, and that's been a... That's been a milestone thing about shortwave, and that is no infrastructure necessary, you know. And it's the same thing with ham radio. No infrastructure. We just talk, and we use Mother Nature. It goes up in the air, comes back down, you know, and it's and it can hop. Oh gosh, there's no, you know, it's very interesting to be sitting in my situation where I'm playing music or talking or something, you know, and all of a sudden an email pops in from some really remote location, just some place that's just, you know, and they're listening to you right that second, you know, that's just, you know, and of course with VOA that's normal. I mean, that's what happens, that's what goes on all the time. And I think for shortwave, that's what makes it really magic. I mean, it's just, you know, we have our good friend Alan Pitts has just sat down, and he's playing with some more technology here. You know, yeah, you know, you think about it. Where would we be today without the technology that we have? I mean, I don't even want to think about what it would be like to go back to a time where we didn't have all these toys.
Well, for me, it's an interesting question in the sense that I've considered a lot of it. And there are, sometimes I look forward to it, and sometimes I think, oh, my God, we're becoming the Borg. So much of our lives are becoming technology-related. Everything and anything, somewheres there's an electronic gizmo involved in the thing. I think where, for me, it really came to light is, okay, I'm standing outside the airport, and, okay, I just handed my bags to TSA to be screened, and, of course, they're all being irradiated, and I'm about to be irradiated. But as I'm standing outside there, getting a last breath of fresh air before I go on into a rather humid airport, I happen to look up, and there's these big black globes. And you know that camera has now pivoted and it's now looking at me. Why are you standing there? And I'm going, I think the world was a little more fun about a century ago sometimes.
Well, you know, but by the same token, it's also, I have on this notebook right here, I can go do two clicks and I'm looking at 9 security cameras at my home. And I can see exactly what's going on. And I mean, but there's some, I guess there's some solace in that. There's some, you know, a peace to be found in it. You know, it's like, you know, we couldn't do that 20 years. I mean, you think to yourself, I wonder, and you click the button, and all of a sudden I got 9 pictures of all the different things that are going on. The cars outside, the backyard, the front yard, the neighbors, I can see it all. You know, and that's something Matthew put in. You know, I mean, him and David put all this in. I mean, but it's live on the internet. So it's
almost a philosophical or even an existential question which is being raised in many ways. In a sense, the technology, we are losing our individuality. We definitely can lose a whole lot of privacy issues and other things that make us uniquely human, with all the foibles and problems that we have as being human. On the flip side, the technology does allow us to do some things, well, a lot of things, that we never could before. And depending on what things we want to get involved with... Now, you can use the technology to do everything from make a new virus to a nuclear bomb, or you can use the technology to make a new friend in a place that you'll never go. What do you want to use the technology for? What type of technology do you want to develop? And for me, that's why I like the amateur radio system. the service allows me to use and develop technology to make friends, not enemies. To help talk with people, learn about people, not make weapons. To make people better human beings. Interacting human beings with other true humans. I love 17 meters for that reason. Where you get to talk with people, real people, and it makes me feel more human and connected to my world, and I think it makes other people that way.
Well, you know, when you get on the air and you meet up with another amateur who is overseas.
Yeah.
You're talking, I mean, even though the world is getting smaller, you're still talking about a completely different culture than you're living in.
Yep.
They pay a different price for their gasoline. They pay a different price for their gallon of milk, if they even drink milk. You know, I mean, and you begin to talk about things like their family. You begin to talk about things like their profession. And you begin to learn. They learn about you. You learn about them. And you realize that as human beings, you're not that far apart. But, boy, your customs are sure different.
Well, you know? He's going to hate me, but I met an Egyptian, S.U., and I can't think of his call sign or his name right now. Oh, boy. Anyway, I met the guy this morning. Now, he and I have talked maybe 15 times. Never had any possibility that we would ever meet. And I just happened to blunder into him outside a booth this morning. And I look and I go, I know you. And I do. I know about his wife. I know about his kids. He knows about my wife and my dog. And it's okay. This is interesting. Now, we haven't talked in a couple of years because of propagation, but we used to meet on 17 meters all the time.
You know, something else is interesting, and I had this happen when I was younger. I was on 40 meters and 75 quite a little bit, and you develop friendship with these guys. You talk to them every day, whatever. And the friendship goes even beyond that of what you would consider to be, a casual friendship that you would have with someone. So here I am. I'm taking off, and I'm going across country. And I've got three or four friends of mine saying, well, hey, come on by here and spend the night with us. And that way you don't have to stay in a hotel and we can talk and have fun and you can go on your way. Well, I did that. I remember I left Nashville. I went to Paducah, Kentucky and stayed with a friend that I talked to all the time on 75. We left there. We went up into the Virginias and we stayed at another ham's house. That we talked to, and then we went up, and then we wound up going home. But it was just interesting that these people would just open their homes up to you. I mean, you'd been talking to them for days and weeks on end. You may know them for 2 or 3 years, and then there. So I can't think of any other way that you could make that kind of a friendship. I mean, maybe there is ways, but
and
I can't.
And this is what I was getting to. This is using technology to make human beings more human. More interactive with other human beings, to get to meet them, to get to know the human experience with them, as opposed to using technology for a number of other either economic or nefarious reasons whatsoever. And, well, okay, you're with TV technology, correct?
Right.
Okay. And it's either lights and wires in a box, if you remember that quote.
Sure.
Or TV can be used to really inform, educate, and truly entertain. And different stations, different capabilities, different channels, different production companies go at it different ways. Some really do try to educate, inform, train, and entertain at the same time. And some, I think we can all agree, just crank out gruel.
But this is not just television. I think...
No,
I go all the way back to DeForest, who invented the triode vacuum tube. Mm-hmm. And once radio took off in the 1920s, somebody interviewed DeForest, and what have you done with my child?
Again,
they've horribly corrupted this child. And again, television, early on in the television era, Vladimir Zarkin, who... went a long way to perfect television, working with RCA. There's no one inventor of television, as you know. But he said basically the same thing. What have you done to my child? You can use it for good. You can educate. You can spread culture. You can do a lot of really great things with any medium. But you can also use it to corrupt, and corrupt horribly.
You know, I want to say, though, one thing. I think as a society, we begin to realize the impact of television.
Oh, yes.
During the assassination of President Kennedy, here's a motorcade going along. We have cameras running. We have a live broadcast. And we have an American president killed on live television. Then we have the situation with Lee Harvey Oswald being shot live on American television. And I think that's probably the first time in the history of television, period, that something of that impact had taken place over a live broadcast where there were millions of eyes watching a historic event just happen spontaneously.
He's here someplace. See if you can get a hold of Walt Palmer. Walt was one of the cameramen when Lee Harvey Oswald was shot.
Oh, really?
He's here. He's a ham.
Wait, with KRLD, possibly, KRLD TV?
I'm not sure.
I believe they had the video up. The camera, at one time, there was a communications museum out near the airport in Dallas. And they actually had the camera, I believe it was an RCA TK-10 image orthicon camera. And there was documentation. This was the camera that was on the air when Ruby shot Oswald.
Yeah, I'm not sure what station he was with, but I've seen pictures from KRLD. And no, there he is with the camera on his shoulder at the time, right on top of things. And I'm going, oh, my. But we have seen more revolutions in technology in our lifetimes than almost all previous generations put together, with the exception of possibly the discovering fire and the wheel. We've seen more happen just within the years that we've been alive, and it's accelerating, as everybody knows. Within the experience of our listeners right now, they have seen the revolution television caused. Now, radio caused one before, but not like television. All of a sudden, now we're bringing these images right into your home. The more recent revolution for communications, I'm leaving out computers for right now, but communications revolution, very simply, was a cell phone. And where we first saw that was Tiananmen Square, and all of a sudden, now we're getting information and pictures out of Tiananmen Square as it was happening. And boy, we really saw that come to the fore in Egypt recently, as to what the capabilities are for what I'll call citizen journalism. People are able to post things. I mean, you cannot stop the communication.
Well, you know, the other thing that's weird, and that is when we were headed into Iraq, the cameras followed the troops right on in. I mean, it was like you were riding along with them.
Yeah, we're all sitting there watching Shock and Awe and going, kind of like a football game, waiting. When before has that ever happened in history?
Well, I think during the Vietnam War, we were getting live images from time to time out of that theater, but not like you're seeing now, certainly because the equipment was not that portable. Satellite transponder time was not that readily available. But the networks did do live programming out of Vietnam on occasion.
I don't remember them live. I do remember every night there were reports from the guys.
Well, there's a big time differential, too.
Yeah, but I don't remember. Maybe there were. I'm not saying there weren't, but I don't remember them live. But very definitely now we're watching things live as they happen, often unedited, unscripted, and who knows what. And technology has allowed that. Does it make my world, and I guess this is the question which I kind of dropped in your conversation, does that make my world better or worse? I'm more informed, but does it make my world better or worse?
I think it goes either way. I mean, but
I don't know.
Let me say this, though. Here we are, you know, and I know your time is limited. You've got a whole bunch of stuff going on over here, and we're sitting here shooting the breeze, you know, like we're sitting at the barbershop, okay? And basically, that's what this is. In other words, and that's what is beautiful about shortwave radio, especially about this radio show, because I like to just get hams together. We talk about everything. But the main thing I would like to talk about, or I'd like to steer this way, and that is this. We have this organization here that's at the other end of the building that we're in, called the American Radio Relay League.
Oh yeah, we got.
And I'm telling you, I mean, the heritage behind this organization is incredible. But not just that, but what has happened with amateur radio is it indeed has socially connected countries, peoples, individuals, groups together through this media. I want to call it a media. Mm-hmm. You can call it a medium, I guess you could say, but it's of amateur radio, and it has provided connections that is just, there's no other way that these people could have ever connected and have ever come to terms. We talked about the fact that TCP over IP,
yep,
invented by hams.
Yep.
Cell phone technology, hams. I'm talking into probably the best broadcast microphone that's ever been built, and that's the Heil PR40 built by a ham, okay? I mean, it goes on and on and on. Things that a lot of folks don't realize. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to talk a little bit about the American Radio Relay League and all the fantastic things they do. Now, we went back and we bought T-shirts. We buy them by the sackful and and take them home. But there's books. There's all sorts of things that, I mean, I walked back there and I was amazed. You've got kids back there soldering on kits. You've got international. You've got people there from all over the world. And there's... Very good. And I want to say, James, thank you for coming by here. I mean, this gentleman's got to go, so we just want to say goodbye to
him. Anytime. I really enjoyed it. I'd love to stay, but I've got somebody waiting for me, so...
I understand totally.
Hope we meet again. Take care. God bless.
But anyways, your job with the American Radio Relay League is as public relations manager. You get a chance to see a little bit of everything, and you get a chance to work with the... all the different aspects of the league and what they're doing, and I'd like you to share a little bit of that with us, because there may be folks out there, and I'm sure there are, that are not members, that hear the ARRL, I guess, logo, banner, or bannered around, the letters ARRL bannered around, but by the same token, they may not totally understand everything that goes on.
Well, ARRL is the National Association for Amateur Radio within the United States. There are a number of other national associations, different countries around the world. And one of the nice things about this year is we brought some of them with us here to Dayton. And they've got their own booths to talk about it. But for the United States, ARRL is the organization which represents amateur radio's interests before the FCC. Right now, we're presenting amateur radio's interests before the Congress. And once we get H.R. 607, which is one of the bills we're concerned about, we'll be presenting other bills before both the Congress and the Senate to promote amateur radio. If you want to find information about amateur radio, where do you go? It would be to the ARRL or to our website. If you want to get a book about a specific topic on amateur radio, where would you go? The answer is ARRL is probably the place. It is, our headquarters is in Newington, Connecticut. We've got approximately 100 employees there. And it is kind of mecca for amateur radio. In such a way, and it's been built up over so many years very, very carefully to have the very brightest, the very best people, that it is recognized as the place around the world. It's not just within the United States, but around the world. If you're looking to get the right information, specific information, good information about amateur radio, this is the place to go. And we're very, very both proud of that, and we're also very protective of that. Now, I won't say that ARRL has always done everything exactly right. It's a human organization like any others. However, at the same time, I truthfully don't know of anyone in ARRL that has tried to do anything for their own gain. Right from the very beginning, with Hiram Percy Maxim, who founded ARRL, the foundation was built on, number one, you promote amateur radio. All of amateur radio. And if you do that, ARRL as an organization will thrive.
Yeah, you
And other organizations have come and gone that tried to promote themselves. ARL is still there because that was one of the founding things, that we will not just promote ARL, but we promote all of amateur radio.
Well, what's interesting, though, we take Hiram Percy Maxim. Here's a man that I think is one of the most fascinating people. Well, I'm truly a great American, you know, but this fella, he had patents of all kinds.
All kinds of things, yeah. Mostly on silencers for weapons.
But also, he brought so much color to amateur radio in the fact that, you know, he was the inventor of the wolf hog.
Oh, yes.
The ready snitch.
Yep.
You know, all these imaginary things that you use to torture what were known as LIDs or bat operators.
You see him, and he looks, in the pictures, he looks stern, like somebody's stern grandfather.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, and at times you read some of his stuff, and no, he's not mincing words. But other things, he comes out with this creative laughter out of history, like the Wolfhung, and you're going, this guy had one heck of a wonderful sense of humor.
I think the message is, basically, that amateur radio can be fun. And even though it has a very serious side, let's don't take it too serious all the time.
Right. If it's not fun, don't do it. Period. I mean, let's face it. If it's not fun, don't do it. You're doing something wrong.
And a lot of folks I've talked to somehow have fallen under this impression that amateur radio was just emergencies and just hard work. And in other words, it was like they didn't understand the fact.
Right.
But they couldn't visualize the enjoyment in it because I guess maybe there's certain types of people that convey that. Now, there are folks that get just totally carried away in emergency communication. I mean,
oh, yes.
And I don't fault them for that. Thank heavens we have those people.
Well, they depends on what's going on. There's basically, and I presented out in Seattle last month, there's basically four levels of people that get wrapped up in emergency communications. Number one is the I'll be there when you need me. And the funny part about these people is, yes, they will be there. They show up out of the woodwork. They may not be ever able to leave their homes, but they are reporting at least what they see down the street. And those reports can become, like they did in Alabama just last month, those reports can be very, very important to getting into an emergency operations center that's looking for them. The second level would be people that have some training in emergency communications. And this would be your normal ARES people that have MCOM level training. Third level would be your ARES leadership people that have substantial training. And then there is the fourth level, the badges, the blue lights, and the want-to-carry-a-gun people. And those, they get scary, okay? But there are some. In general, though, there are three different things that bring people to amateur radio. One is emergency stuff, and that's becoming more and more important, and more you see that in the media. The second one is what we were talking about before, the fun, the fellowship, the fun of talking DX, the fun of, in a sense, it's like going fishing. You get on the air, you know what propagation is supposed to be, but that doesn't necessarily mean all of a sudden somebody's not going to pop up from Japan or someplace else. And you end up talking to a place that you didn't even sometimes know existed. And you end up talking with some people. And you got to go to a map to find out where you were just talking
to. Happened
to
me more than
and
once.
That's like, happened to me,
and
too.
I don't want
to
let on. Hey, man, I don't know where you are, but I don't want to let on like I don't know where you are.
And you can have a very nice conversation. And when you get all through, you go, what was that all about? The third one is the technology people. And now I'm focusing a lot more on these people this year. These are usually in the range of 16 to 26-year-old. They're do-it-yourself people. They probably have subscriptions to Make magazine. They're over there with the kit-building stuff. They'll be at the forums. In a sense, they're the people that like to tinker in the attics in the basement, that likes to take the box apart and not only find out what makes it work, but maybe we can make it do something else. And, boy, that's a true ham if I ever defined one. That's where it all started. There's more and more of these people, but they're getting involved with computers and everything else. And yet, the way they are approaching things, that's ham radio. That's where we started out. So if we can teach them or bring them to understand the capabilities that the electronic radio spectrum has and what ham radio has for experimentation, that we're literally the last place that you can experiment with electromagnetic radiation without being a corporation or a government entity, as the ham radio bands, then we can go and claim more and more of these people as ours. And we're working on right now a video. And we're going to start there, which is going to be a really first-class video of approximately 12, 15 minutes in length, with auxiliary short little videos supporting it that'll be what I call YouTube size. And we're hoping to come out with those. Should be middle to end of September. And once we do, we're going to be making a whole lot of noise about those to try and get that information in front of this type of crew. These are the kids that are right now, they're out, some college-age people and all, they're out there launching a balloon right now that they think is going to go to like 100,000 feet in the air. They're launching balloons. They're doing all kinds of interesting things. And, well, they're, as far as I'm concerned, they're hams. The mentality is ham. So we're going to see if we can attract them also and claim them as ours.
One of the things that struck friends of mine that have never been exposed to this is we had a storm blow up, and they came over and they were listening to one of the repeaters where ARES was operating with storm spotters.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the television was on. And I said, now you watch this. I said, the storm spotter is going to report something. I don't know what, but yep. Something. I said, and you will hear that then relayed to the National Weather Service office. And I said, within a matter of minutes, not even minutes, but maybe seconds, I don't know, if you just watch this happen, then you're going to see it scroll across the bottom of the television screen. And they were there looking at me kind of doubtful, you know, thinking, no, that couldn't possibly be. Well, the next thing you know, storm spotter said something. I don't know what it was. The winds were hail, dime-sized hail.
Hail report.
Whatever,
yeah.
You know. And you heard the report. We heard it relayed to the Weather Service. And then with the matter, just a few minutes, I mean, there was a little time lag. The scroll came a lot across the television screen, you know, and I said, now, you know, they have all this sophisticated radar and all these things that they're using, you know, but there is nothing that will ever replace the human being standing there watching this and says, this rain feels wet, you know,
yep.
you know that they know that they know.
Yeah, they even with the good radar systems that they've got now, basically they'll be honest with you. They can't see the last, I think it's like 4,000 feet because of the curvature of the earth, because of buildings, and because of a number of different terrain problems. Usually it's about the last 3,000 or 4,000 feet, if I remember right. They've got a big blind spot. And that's where they're looking for people on the ground to be able to relay in. What are they seeing? What are they happening? And that's what I say. These are the, I'll be there when you need me, guys, that may have very minimal training, but they can look out a window and tell you what they see.
Well, something happened to me, and I've told this at our Society of Broadcast Engineers meetings a couple of times. We're trying to relate amateur radio, and how it is something that responds in terms of time. I was on WSM FM in Nashville, on the air, in the studio, and this is a very unusual station from the standpoint it's part of the heritage of WSM and the Grand Ole Opry and all this, you know, and we're out in the Opryland theme park. The studio is in the middle of the theme park. So you have to walk out into the theme park, open the door, go in the studio, and there's all glass, and so when the park opens in the morning, all these people flood by, you know, and so you kind of have to be dressed appropriately, and you can't do anything weird in front of the glass, and all, you know. And so, anyways, I've got my little HT with me at the time,
and you're behaving.
No, I'm trying to. I got the HT with me, and I've got it set up, and I'm listening to the Opryland security people on there, and I'm also listening to the WeatherNet, because we got some some storm blowing in. At least that was the rumor. Bad thing coming. And so I'm listening, and all of a sudden, we hear this bad storm coming in. We hear the reports of funnels and wall clouds and things that were they're being reported. And then all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, this guy says, I'm at 2 Mile Parkway and Gallatin Road. There is a funnel on the ground. And I thought, oh, boy. So what did I do? I reached over, and I just potted the music down, opened the mic, and I said, it's been reported to us. I said, you know, I came in, ladies and gentlemen, let me have your attention, please. It's just been reported to us.
There's missiles incoming at 11.
There is a funnel on the ground at Gallatin Road and 2 Mile Parkway. If you're in that area, take cover immediately. Don't wait. Okay, so I got that out. And I when I shut the mic off and brought the music back up, I thought, I wonder how appropriate that was. You know, was I supposed to do that or not? You know, now here's what happened.
I have never heard. Maybe it's happened, but truthfully, I have never heard of a false weather report by a licensed tail. I have heard reports that may have not been clear. Mm-hmm. I have heard reports where, boy, that's an ugly looking cloud, and you know you're not sure exactly what it means. But I've never heard a false report.
Well, anyhow, I got this out on the air, and radio station management came by, or called me in, mm-hmm. and said, you really ought not to do that. And you know why they did that? Because they were uninformed. They did not understand. They did not understand what weather spotters were. They didn't understand that the weather spotters were trained by the National Weather Service Office. They didn't understand what amateur radio was. They didn't understand any of it. So they felt it prudent to chew me out for going over the air and making that announcement. Now, the interesting thing was, is that tornado hit the ground. And about a week later, we had, somebody called me and said, can you come to the general manager's office? I went to the GM's office. The general manager of the restaurant over there, the Olive Garden, had showed up at the headquarters of WSM, WSM-FM, and it came in and was there thanking the radio station because the restaurant manager had gone into the kitchen and one of the cooks back there had the FM station on and they were listening. He heard the announcement that I made just by chance. Mm-hmm. He walked back there just and heard this announcement. He went out into the dining room and told all the customers to get under the tables immediately. And within seconds, that tornado ripped the roof right off of that restaurant. I mean, tore it plumb off. It threw stuff around, and there was not one single injury, not even a scratch, because everyone had got under the table. Now, I stopped and thought about that. I thought, now here, the chain that took place there was simple.
Do you hear God laughing?
Yeah. here's a radio ham, sees this, mm-hmm. I remember, because he was kind of excited when he made the announcement.
Yep.
You know, you could tell that he was like, oh, God, I got to tell somebody this is, you know. And he's saying this, and with a matter of just a few seconds, yep. I had it on the air, and within that same period of time, but I thought about it, and I thought, see, this is a good thing. You know, this is really a good thing, because the time factor was so critical there, and if we could just do more of that kind of stuff, you know. And it wasn't me. I didn't do anything special. I like the weather spotter. There's the guy. He's the guy out risking his neck out in this weather, you know.
Well, in a sense, I look at it, and I got to admit, I look at it in two different ways. One is you've got the capabilities of amateur radio in that story. Then they're very obvious that if it was not for amateur radio, the weather spotter, and what hams do, there would have been, obviously, injuries and or death. The other is, I think most hams can come up and share somewheres there's a story of coincidences, things that should not have lined up the way they did, and yet they do. Amateur radio is involved, and good things come out of it. Things that, in a sense, All the planets were in alignment. You know, the moon was in Aquarius and Venus was Mars. He makes the announcement. You happen to hear it. You're on the air. They happen to hear it in the kitchen. the coincidence. I think most hams can do and talk about something like that happening. But when it does, it happens, in a sense, I call it God's laughter. But it happens because of the capabilities of amateur radio, the dedication of amateur radio, the truth and the veracity of amateur radio people that get on. If a ham says over the air that this is the way something is, that something's happening, you believe it. And people act on it. And we accept that. I'd be very surprised if it wasn't. I've never heard of it happen. And when you put it all together, how many people would know about amateur radios? You hear about death and destruction. How many people actually heard? How many people were in that restaurant? Amateur radio saves 40 lives.
And then how many other literal thousands of lives does that affect? Because everybody there has a mother, a father,
and nobody,
kids.
And nobody knows.
You know.
And nobody knows. Alabama. The storm spotters that were out there, some of them running like heck for themselves, diving for cover because all of a sudden the tornado's on. They're not chasing the storm. The storms are chasing them.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's amazing, too. Somebody does that, goes out. And after a lot of training, I mean, and they pretty well there have an idea how the storm is going to move. They based on experience and the way these things go, laws of physics. But then every once in a while, there's this unexpected thing that happens that is not supposed to happen.
Yeah, and a lot of them happened last in Alabama. Not to leave some of the other places out, but boy, did they get hammered. We even had some of our staff down there that are trained in emergency communication stuff. This is what they do full time. And all of a sudden, they're diving for cover themselves. Yet, because of them, how many lives were saved? You see the death and the destruction and everything else. But because of their reports, because of their activities, because of getting the information out, the information that people needed to the people that needed it in a timely way, how many lives were saved?
Well, you know, the other thing, too, is after a disaster has taken place, you know, communications are just overloaded. I mean, if police radios...
Even if they're still there, they're right. Overloaded.
And what little infrastructure may be left, yeah, you're right. Because I got a cousin in Clarksville, Tennessee, and we were just talking about he's like been the head of Homeland Security there in Montgomery County. And he was just very, very bold about it. He told me, he said, there's sometimes, I don't know what we would do if there weren't radio hams helping us out when we get into situations that we just simply can't get out of.
Well, I just came out of a forum where Ed Tyler, who is the public information coordinator for this section, Alabama section, I had asked Ed if he'd present there. And he said one of the things that they learned very quickly in Alabama, everybody had these wonderful charts as to who and, you know, how and who was going to be in charge of what and what was going to be where. And this, here's the section manager. Here's their home phone. Here's their cell phone. Here's their email. This emergency operations center. Here's their staff, you know, the home phone, the cell phone, the email. And they had all this. And it was absolutely wonderful up on the paper. There's only one problem. When the tornadoes hit, there was no home. There was no cell phone, and there was no email. Now, how do you get a hold of these guys? How do you set or reestablish your chain of command and communications when these people aren't there? And the hams had to come on in and, in a sense, build things up from absolutely nothing in many of these cases. As a matter of fact, as I get it, one of the emergency operations center, literally the whole operations center, which was half built halfway in the ground, it had pulled the actual EOC partly up out of the ground.
Wow. You know, and I guess after a disaster takes place and you've got hams on board, it's almost like a magic that takes place in terms of the fact that even though you have the Red Cross there and you have all these people there, amateur radio operators will coordinate, and all of a sudden there is that line of communication that makes it possible for food and water and all kinds of supplies to be taken into areas because the hams can connect those two areas together, and they can instantly report what the needs are in an area. It's a missing link that just doesn't exist without amateur radio.
Yeah, and this is one of the traditional roles. ARL has literally written memorandum of understanding to provide communications in disasters for Red Cross, for the Salvation Army, for a number of other organizations. I'm looking at the idea of very soon, and I hope if you're listening, I would like to see you developing an MOU with the Baptist Disaster Response Services. I have seen these people. I know some of their people rather well, and I would really like to see a formal recognition there also. We are allied with everything from FEMA through the National Weather Service on down to nonprofit organizations of all kinds, and we provide them the communications. We're not the first responders. We're not even necessarily second responders as such, but we are the people that provide the communications for those that do respond in the recovery efforts, and we're very, very proud of that.
Well, I guess the other thing is that the league itself is what synergizes all of this, and it allows folks all over the country to know about what hams are doing, and to know, I mean, and to provide some infrastructure so that, and when I say, or structure, so to speak, so that there is an organization to belong to, and you know where to locate your local club, and you know where the local ham fest is, and this is like what's going on here at Dayton. The really close tie between the Dayton Hamvention and the American Radio Relay League. All this is so important, and I want to, I guess, encourage folks, be a part of this. You know, get involved in it. You know, if you don't do anything else other than join the league, you know, get QST Magazine and read and look online and be informed and be a part of it. Because the league does and covers so many areas and does so many things that without the league, this hobby would be a mess. It really would be. No. We would be eaten alive.
No question. When you say we would be eaten alive, the answer is absolutely yes. The different commercial interests and others would want our frequencies. They'd be long gone, long before now, when they're still working on it now. I can say that the league provides the materials, provides the resources for amateur radio people to do a lot of things. From my particular end, from public relations, if you want to promote amateur radio in your local area, we have the materials for you. They're freely available. You can download them, turn around, modify them, make them your own. They are professional level, first quality materials to promote amateur radio, which we make available for people to localize and promote your own club, promote whatever it may be related to amateur radio within your home area. We can't do it all. We ask you to do it, but we'll make the materials available for you. In many other ways, the league does the same things in so many different activities. Everything from 70% of the testing that is done to get amateur radio licenses, actually a little more than 70, is done through ARRL volunteer examiners. We're looking at the education of emergency people. We were talking about emergency stuff. Who has the courses? Not just the FEMA courses, but specific courses on amateur radio communications in disasters. ARRL has it. If you've got a problem with radio interference in your home, who's got the books on RFI? ARRL has that. If you've got trying to make an organization for a club, you want to start a club, who's got the ability to help you? Who's got the materials, the time, the wisdom, and the experience of what works, what doesn't? And we'll share it with you. ARRL will. So there's a lot more than just the QST subscription. As you get more and more involved with amateur radio, people come to appreciate ARRL.
Well, what's really amazing, too, because I've collected QST over the years. I have bookcases and bookcases.
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, now you don't have to do that anymore, because all of those magazines are archived online, and you can go up there. You can find an article by just typing the name of the article in, or what, you know, whatever.
You still have to be a member, but you can get into the archives.
No, what I'm saying is that is a benefit of the members. If you're a member, you become a member of the league, the number of benefits are really too numerous to mention during the time that we've got.
That has been a major project, getting those things all squared away electronically, getting them on the website, getting everything organized on there. That has been a big project, and it worked out rather well.
I don't want to keep you beyond your limit. I know you got to get back. I want to thank you for coming by here. And once again, folks that want to join, go to ARRL.org on the internet. They make ARRL.com works as well, does it not?
Don't know, but it probably does.
Yeah, it probably points to it. Go into Google and just put in ARRL. You're going to find your way there.
Oh, yes.
And take a look at the website. And if you're a licensed ham and you're not a member, you really should be. If you're a licensed ham and you were a member, you really should be. I guess I can't really emphasize that enough, because I think there's definitely strength in numbers. And the more the merrier in terms of this. Plus, you know, get involved. Get involved in a local club somewhere. Get involved in some facet of this hobby. Because it isn't just emergency communications, it's also an incredible amount of fun, and as Alan says, a lot of fellowship involved.
That's it.
You know, and you know what? There's a lot of lonely people in this world, and ham radio can take the lonely right out of your life, because you've got somebody to talk to 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can find someone to talk to. And but it's true, you know, because I grew up as an only child. And I, when I would go into my room at night, I realized that when I walked into that was a gateway to the entire world. I 2 o'clock in the morning, there's somebody to talk to.
Yeah. Turn off this radio and go turn on your own radio. go talk to somebody.
Alan Pitts is the public relations manager for the league. And if you need him for something, you can contact him at league headquarters in Newington, Connecticut. And I thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you, Ted, very much.
Once again, we are live, and we are at the Dayton Hamvention 2011. And I guess I want to have to say that looking around, this is the place. In other words, if you're into amateur radio, if you like shortwave radio, if you like technology, just technology, period, this is a place to be. There's an incredible amount of manufacturers here, and there's a type of technology here that you're not going to see other places, because amateur radio is always based on experimentation and creativity that you just don't find anywhere else. I got a fellow standing outside here, or standing by the booth. And are you from Destin, Florida? You're not. Sit down there and tell me where you're from right now. Where? What part of the country are you from?
My name is Russell Turpin, and I'm from Benton, Arkansas.
Benton, Arkansas.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you've got the HT on your hip, so that means you're probably a ham.
Yes.
And what brings you to the Dayton Hamvention?
Well, I've been coming since 1976.
See there? I think you have a problem. You know, I mean, this is... Did you ever think that you might be a little obsessive-compulsive about this hobby?
Yes.
Well, tell me, what's your favorite part of the hobby? What is it that really gets your attention, the things that you enjoy the most about amateur radio?
Well, there's three things. AM operation, single sideband, and CW.
Okay, so now you are probably mostly an HF operator, more so than VHF.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
So what do you like about AM? You know, I'll tell you, I hear up and down, I'm listening on, let's say, 75 and 40 meters, and some of these fellows that are on there, boy, they're just real bitter about guys on AM. So tell me, I think AM sounds cool. I love listening to the audio. I like it when somebody's got a Heil microphone or a broadcast mic hooked up, and they're and their maybe their signal's a little broader than the normal narrow sound that you get on sideband. But what is it that draws you to AM? What fascinates you?
Well, the fidelity of the AM signal. And I use vintage equipment, plate modulated. So I enjoy the idea of taking a step back in time to see how the radio technology was of the 50s. And so at that and the fidelity of AM, the smooth sounds that it produces.
Now, when you say you're into vintage equipment, tell me a little bit about what you're running or what you use.
My main AM transmitter is a Collins 30K4, which was produced by Collins in the early 1950s. And they made a Collins 30K1 for amateur use. The 30K4 was produced for commercial communications, mostly police, dispatch units, ground to air, that sort of thing. It's 6 feet tall and weighs 400 pounds.
Have you ever thought, and I'm just curious, have you ever thought about using a commercial AM broadcast transmitter that's been retired from service someplace?
No, I have a house that's built on a conventional construction, and I'm just afraid it would fall through the floor. They weigh in excess of 1,000 pounds, but I know people do that. But they live mostly in slab construction.
Well, you know, I was going to say, I've got on and listened, and I'm hearing guys running homebrew PDM modulated transmitters, all sorts of new digital modulated schemes on AM that they've built themselves. And the stuff sounds really, really good.
They do. So-called Class E modulation, Flex Radio, the new SDR radios sound fantastic on AM.
And I wonder how, I don't know how that works, but when you take old plate-modulated transmitters, like, for example, the Johnson Viking 2, the Heathkit DX100, and I was just telling these guys earlier, at one point in time, I had a Globe Champ 300. That thing had audio on it that just wouldn't quit, but I have not seen one since the one I had. I've not seen one anywhere. And I remember it had a compression switch on it. You hit the compression switch, and it would throw some AGC into the circuit, you know, and it just really sounded good. But have you ever played around or done any home brewing like that? Any of the?
No, I really haven't. Most of my time in amateur radio is spent on the air, actually operating. I have a friend, Howard Mills, who is a real artisan when it comes to restoring older AM equipment. So I usually get him to do the work, and I enjoy the radio.
So you now, how do you see AM operation differ, let's say, from the average single sideband QSOs? I mean, you hear people on, you know, doing roundtable things, but what do you find on AM that's different than the average sideband QSO?
Well, there are a lot of differences. As I said, operating AM is like stepping back in time. And so the typical AM QSO is long transmissions, 10-minute transmissions or longer, where you're actually doing sort of a monologue. And the conversations tend to be technical, talking about the circuitry of that era. So a lot of the fellows that are on AM today were broadcast engineers. They're very familiar with the circuits of the equipment that they're using.
I've listened, and it seemed like they were... But I've heard sideband QSOs that were... The guys are pretty long-winded, you know. But, I mean, it seemed like the AM the AM guys were maybe more laid back and a little bit more conversational, not quite as maybe as tense as you'd feel listening to a sideband QSO.
Yeah, I think
maybe that's my take on it.
There may be some truth to that. Most of the AM guys, not all, but a lot of the AMers are old-time radio men, been around the hobby and radio for many, many years.
Well, there's a fellow that works for the station that we're on now, WBCQ. Actually, I don't see he works for the station. He's part of the station, and that's Tim Tron. And I think it's, what is his call sign? It's right on the tip of my tongue. HLR, I think maybe is his call sign. And I met him through a fellow that works for Energionics, which is a transmitter company up in New York. A fellow by the name of Jamie Labate. And I don't know what Jamie's call sign is. But they are both heavy AM operators. And they're both very, very skilled technically. I don't think you can get to the point where you know more about RF than Tim that works over at BCQ or is part of BCQ. But that does seem to be the case.
If you're interested in AM, you can learn a lot about the technology from just listening to the QSOs that are on AM. And I'll also say this, that AM over the last several years, maybe 5 years, has seen a resurgence in interest. There's a lot of people that are doing AM, using AM, even in new modern equipment. Fortunately, there's still an AM mode button on modern equipment.
Well, sir, once again, give me your name and your call sign.
It's Russell Turpin.
Okay.
And the call sign is Whiskey Alpha 4 Kilowatt Charlie November, WA4KCN.
And you're when you're operating, when you go home, you're heading into, did you say Arkansas?
Yes.
Okay. So I really want to say thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Yeah, and AM radio is always fascinating, especially ham radio. The operation of AM is a fascinating thing. I find it fascinating. It's good you came by here because...
Thank you.
Well, that's about going to wrap up our broadcast here. We've been here all day. We'll be back tomorrow. And I would imagine we'll be on the air tomorrow starting at around 12 noon Central Daylight Time. And we want to invite you to come back. The frequency is 7415. And if you go to the website, Ted Randall at tedrandall.com, you can find the link for the stream. And, of course, we're streaming live as we go. So be sure to go to the website, Ted Randall. At TedRandall.com is my email address. Email me, TedRandall@TedRandall.com, or TedRandall.com is the website. You can also get there by going to QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And I want to say thanks to Rod Hembry for allowing us to don at this particular time from the Dayton Hamvention. And we'll be back tomorrow. And once again, thank you so much for tuning our way and for listening. This is WBCQ, Monticello, Maine.
tells me that I'm just a fool, and that I never should have put my faith in you. And when I'm deep inside, girl, I know it's true, but no one else can make me feel the way you do. And you got me under your spell again, again, making me believe that you're just mine. You've got me scheming those schemes again, dreaming those dreams again. I gotta take you back just one more time. You've got me under your spell again. I'm saying those things again.
Can't you see that I'm all on your love? Now, can't you see? Can't you see how much you need some more love, baby? Can't you see? Oh, now, can't you see? Since we kissed that night, ever since I felt your touch, I just don't want nobody else. So put your lips on mine, leave them there till the morning shine. Lord, don't leave me by myself. Hey, lay a little loving on me.
Lay a little loving on me.
Honey, don't depend upon it. So lay a little loving on me. Let me hear you now. Every day is not enough for you, baby. I'm saying every day. I need the day and every night time too, baby.
Every day.
Oh,
every day.
Don't you know what I got inside? Love's big time. Love that's growing day by day. You're such a pretty child. You're about to drive me wild.
Should be doing that now.